Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Shabbat shalom, everybody. So, we're in Shemot. So, Exodus chapter 1, verse 1 through Exodus chapter 6, verse 1. And these are the names of the children of Israel who were coming to Egypt with Jacob. Each man and his household came. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin. Dan, and Naphtali. Gad, and Asher. And all the persons who emerged from Jacob's loins were 70 souls. And Joseph was in Egypt. Joseph died, and all of his brothers, and that entire generation. The children of Israel were fruitful, teemed, increased, and became strong. Very, very much so, and the land became filled with them. A new king arose over Egypt who did not know of Joseph. He said to his people, "Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more numerous and stronger than we. Come, let us outsmart it. Let at least it become numerous, and it may be that if a war will occur, it too may join our enemies and wage war against us and go up from the land." So they appointed taskmasters over it in order to afflict it with their burdens. It built storage cities for Pharaoh, Pitom, and Ramses. But as much as they would afflict it, so it would increase, and so it would spread out, and they became disgusted because of the children of Israel. Egypt enslaved the children of Israel with crushing harshness. They embittered their lives with hard work, with mortar, and with bricks, with every labor of the field. All their labors that they performed with them were of crushing hardness. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of the first was Shifra, and of the second was Puah. He said, "When you deliver the Hebrew women, and you see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you are to kill him, and if it is a daughter, she shall live." But the midwives feared God, and they did not do as the king of Egypt spoke to them, and they caused the boys to live. The king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this thing that you have caused the boys to live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are unlike the Egyptian women, for they are experts. For the midwives come to them, they have given birth." God benefited the midwives, and the people increased and became very strong. And it was because the midwives feared God that he made them houses. Pharaoh commanded his entire people, saying, "Every son that will be born into the river shall you throw him, and every daughter you shall keep alive." A man went from the house of Levi and took a daughter of Levi. The woman conceived and gave birth to a son. She saw that he was good, and she hid him for 3 months. She could not hide him any longer, so she took for him a wicker basket and smeared it with clay and pitch. She placed the child into it and placed it among the reeds at the bank of the river. His sister stationed herself at a distance to know what would be done with him. Pharaoh's daughter went down to bathe by the river, and her maidens walked along the river. She saw the basket among the reeds, and she sent her maidservant, and she took it. She opened it and saw him, the child. And behold, a youth was crying. She took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrew boys." His sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and summon for you a wet nurse, the Hebrew woman, who will nurse the boy for you?" The daughter of Pharaoh said, "Go." The girl went and summoned the boy's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this boy and nurse him for me, and I will give you your pay." So the woman took the boy and nursed him. The boy grew up, and she brought him to the daughter of Pharaoh, and he was a son to her. She called his name Moses, as she had said, "For I drew him from the water." It happened in those days that Moses grew up and went out to his brethren and observed their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian man striking a Hebrew man of his brethren. He turned this way and that and saw that there was no man. So he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. He went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. He said to the wicked one, "Why would you strike your fellow?" He replied, "Who appointed you as a dignitary, a ruler, and a judge over us? Do you propose to murder me as you murdered the Egyptian?" Moses was frightened, and he thought, "Indeed, the matter is now known." Pharaoh heard about this matter and sought to kill Moses. So Moses fled from before Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian. He sat by a well. The minister of Midian had 7 daughters. They came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's sheep. The shepherds came and drove them away. Moses got up and saved them and watered their sheep. They came to Reuel, their father. He said, "How could you have come so quickly today?" They replied, "An Egyptian man saved us from the shepherds, and he even drew water for us and watered the sheep." He said to his daughters, "Then where is he? Why did you leave the man? Summon him and let him eat bread." Moses desired to dwell with the man, and he gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses. She gave birth to a son. He named him Gershom. For he said, "I have been a stranger in a foreign land." During those many days, it happened, the king of Egypt died. The children of Israel groaned because of the work, and they cried out. Their outcry because of the work God went up to God. God heard their moaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the children of Israel, and God knew. Moses was shepherding the sheep of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. He guided the sheep far into the wilderness, and he arrived at the mountain of God toward Horeb. An angel of God appeared to him in a blaze of fire from amidst the bush. He saw, and behold, the bush was burning in the fire, but the bush was not consumed. Moses thought, "I will turn aside now and look at this great sight. Why will the bush not be burned?" The Lord saw that he turned aside to see, and God called out to him from amidst the bush and said, "Moses, Moses." He replied, "Here I am." He said, "Do not come closer to here. Remove your shoes from your feet, for the place on which you stand is holy ground." And he said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to gaze toward God. The Lord said, "I have indeed seen the affliction of my people that is in Egypt, and I have heard its outcry because of its taskmasters, for I have known of its sufferings. I shall descend to rescue it from the hand of Egypt and to bring it up from that land to a good and spacious land, to land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Jebusite, and the Jebusite. And now, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Now go, and I shall dispatch you to Pharaoh, and you shall take my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." Moses replied to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, and that I should take the children of Israel out of Egypt?" And he said, "For I shall be with you, and this is your sign that I have sent you. When you take the people out of Egypt, you will serve God on this mountain." Moses said to God, "Behold, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they say to me, 'What is his name?' what shall I say to them?" Lord answered, "I shall be as I shall be," he said. "So shall you say to the children of Israel, 'I shall be has sent me to you.'" And God further to Moses said, "So shall you say the children of Israel, 'The Lord, the God of your forefathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has dispatched me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my remembrance from generation to generation. Go and gather the elders of Israel and say to them, 'The Lord, the God of your forefathers, has appeared to me, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and God of Jacob, saying, I have surely remembered you and what was done to you in Egypt. And I have said, I shall bring you up from the affliction of the Egypt to the land of Canaan, the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite, to the land flowing with milk and honey. They will heed your voice. You and the elders of Israel shall come to the king of Egypt and say to him, 'Lord, the God of the Hebrews, happened upon us, and now please let us go on a 3-day journey in the wilderness. And we shall bring offerings to the Lord our God. I know the king of Egypt will not allow you to go, except through a strong hand. I shall stretch out my hand, and I shall strike Egypt with all my wonders. I shall perform in its midst, and after that he will send you out. I shall grant this people favor in the eyes of Egypt, so that it will happen that when you go, you will not go empty-handed. Each woman shall request from her neighbor and from the one who lives in her house vessels, silver vessels, golden vessels, and garments. You shall put them on your sons and daughters, and you shall empty out Egypt." Chapter 4. Moses responded, saying, "But they will not believe me, and they will not heed my voice, for they will say, 'God did not appear to you.'" The Lord said to him, "What is that in your hand?" He replied, "A staff." He said, "Cast it on the ground." He cast it on the ground, and it became a snake. Moses fled from it, and the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand and grasp its tail." He stretched out his hand and grasped it tightly, and it became a staff in his palm. "So they shall believe the Lord, the God of their forefathers, that has appeared to you, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob." The Lord said further to him, "Bring your hand into your bosom." He brought his hand to his bosom. Then he withdrew it, to behold his hand was leprous like snow. He said, "Return your hand to your bosom." He returned his hand to his bosom, then removed it in his bosom, and behold, it reverted to be like his flesh. "It shall be, if they do not believe you, and do not heed the voice of the first sign, they will believe the voice of the latter sign. It shall be, if they do not believe even these two signs, and do not heed your voice, that you shall take from the water of the river, and pour it out on the dry land. And the water you shall take from the river, it will become blood when it reaches on the dry land." Moses replied to the Lord, "Please, my Lord, I am not a man of words, not since yesterday, nor since the day before yesterday, nor since you first spoke to your servant, for I am a heavy-mouthed and heavy of speech." The Lord said to him, "Who makes a mouth for a man? Who makes one dumb or deaf or sighted or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? So now go. I shall with your mouth and teach you what you should say." He replied, "Please, my Lord, send through whomever you will send." The wrath of the Lord burned against Moses. He said, "Is it not Aaron your brother, the Levite? I know that he will surely speak. Moreover, behold, he is coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he will rejoice in his heart. You shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I shall be with your mouth and with his mouth, and teach you both what you are to do. He shall speak for you to the people, and it will be that he will be your mouth, and you will be his leader. And his staff you shall take in your hand, with which you shall perform the signs. So Moses went and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, "Let me go back now to my brethren who are in Egypt, and see if they are still alive." Jethro said to Moses, "Go in peace." The Lord said to Moses in Midian, "Go, return to Egypt, for all the people who seek your life have died." So Moses took his wife and sons, mounted them on the donkey, and returned to the land of Egypt. Moses took the staff of God in his hand. The Lord said to Moses, "When you go to return to Egypt, see all the wonders that I have put in your hand and perform them before Pharaoh. But I shall strengthen his heart. He will not send out the people. You shall say to Pharaoh, 'So says the Lord, my firstborn son is Israel.' So I say to you, send out my son that he may serve me. But you have refused to send him out. Behold, I shall kill your firstborn son." It was on the way in the lodging that the Lord encountered him and sought to kill him. So Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and touched it to his feet. And she said, "You caused my bridegroom's bloodshed." She released him. So he released him. Then she said, "A bridegroom's bloodshed because of the circumcision." The Lord said to Aaron, Go meet Moses in the wilderness." So he went. He encountered him at the mountain of God, and he kissed him, and Moses related to Aaron all the words of the Lord that he had dispatched him, and all the signs that he had commanded him. Moses and Aaron went and gathered all the elders of the children of Israel. Aaron spoke all the words the Lord had spoken to Moses. He performed the signs in the sight of the people. The people believed, and they heard the Lord and remembered the children of Israel, that he saw their affliction, and they bowed their heads and prostrated themselves. Afterward, Moses and Aaron came and said to Pharaoh, "So says the Lord, the God of Israel, send out my people, they may celebrate for me in the wilderness." Pharaoh replied, "Who is the Lord that I should heed his voice to send out Israel? I do not know him, nor will I send out Israel." So he said, "The God of the Hebrews happened upon us. Let us now go for a 3-day journey in the wilderness. We shall bring offerings to the Lord our God, lest he strike us dead with plague or the sword." The king of Egypt said to them, "Moses and Aaron, why do you disturb the people from its work? Go to your own burdens." And Pharaoh said, "Behold, the people of the land are now numerous, and would you have them cease from their burdens?" On that day, Pharaoh ordered the taskmasters over the people and its foremen, saying, "You shall no longer give straw to the people to manufacture bricks as yesterday and before yesterday. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the quota of bricks they are making yesterday and before yesterday, you shall impose upon them. Do not reduce it. For they are lazy. Therefore they cry out, saying, 'Let us go and bring offerings to our God.' Let the work be heavier upon the men, and let them engage in it, and let them not pay any attention to false words." The taskmasters of the people and its foremen went out and spoke to people, saying, "So said Pharaoh, I am not giving you straw. Go yourselves and take yourselves straw from whatever you can find, for nothing will be reduced from your work." So people spread out through the entire land of Egypt to gather gleanings for straw. The taskmasters pressed, saying, "Complete your work, the daily matter each day, as it was when there was straw." The former children of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had appointed over them, were beaten, saying, "Why did you not complete your requirement to make bricks, as yesterday and before yesterday, even yesterday and even today?" The former children of Israel came and cried out to Pharaoh, saying, "Why do you do this to your servants? Straw is not given to your servants, yet they tell us, 'Make bricks.' But your servants are being beaten, and it's a sin for your people." He said, "You are lazy, lazy. Therefore, you say, 'Let us go and bring offerings to the Lord.' Now go to work. shall will not be given to you, but you must provide the quota of bricks. The former children of Israel saw them in distress when they said, do not reduce your bricks, the daily matter, each day. They encountered Moses and Aaron standing up opposite them as they left Pharaoh's presence. They said to them, may the Lord God look upon you and judge, for you have made our very scent abhorrent in the eyes of Pharaoh and the eyes of his servants, place a sword in their hands to murder us. Moses returned to the Lord and said, my Lord, why have you done evil to this people? Why have you sent me? For the time I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he did evil to this people, but you did not rescue your people. The Lord said to Moses, now you shall see what I shall do to Pharaoh. But through a strong hand will he send them out. And with a strong hand will he drive them from his land. That was Exodus, Shemot, chapter 1 through the first verse, chapter 6. Yes, Louise.
He was in the bulrushes. His sister was watching to see what would happen to him. Pharaoh's daughter came and got him. The sister told the mom. The mom went to Pharaoh. She somehow got the job of nursing him. How did Moses know who his people were?
Great question. That's a great question. If Moses was a little boy and was raised in Pharaoh's household, how would he even have an association with Israel? He'd raise him as the kings of Egypt were raised, because they're all in Pharaoh's household. We'll talk about that in some detail today, but not extensively. Not to the favorite whipping boy of the Hollywood movies, not to peg them on anything, and they weren't that bad. Pharaoh's daughter. If records are correct, which every change, if Egyptian history and chronology changes probably every year to determine new stuff because how poorly the records were kept. But Hatshepsut was the daughter that found Moses. And she's about between 10 to 15 years old when this event happens in her life. She's a relatively young girl. Not a little baby, but not an old one, but someone in that ballpark. She winds up marrying her step half brother. It's kind of weird. It's kind of gross. But anyway, later on, and she is the first wife, but she has no sons. She only has daughters. So Moses, being the adopted son of hers, for the first part of his life, is raised as the firstborn son of Pharaoh for years. Until the Pharaoh has a son with one of his other wives. I forgot her name. It's something else. And then eventually, when that happens, he's a biological son. Then those two sons have issues, and Moses has to leave, obviously. We'll discuss that in more detail shortly. But so Moses knew where he came from because he was an adopted son. He knew that his mother, Pharaoh's daughter, the one who was raising him, she wasn't married. She had no children of her own. She's only between 10 and 15 years older than he is. So he knows, you didn't give birth to me. That's a given. That's clearly what had happened. He is an adopted son, though, much like we learned from the last Torah portion with Manasseh and Ephraim. When you're adopted, you are as if you are a son. You are a whole, full-blooded, full rights, everything is there. So if Egyptian daughter, Pharaoh's daughter, adopts Moses, full rights with him as a firstborn son of hers. So whomever she marries, he is that firstborn son of whatever her husband is. That's how adoption works. But Moses knew he didn't belong. Hebrews, I think it's chapter, I forgot what chapter it is. 10 or 11, something like that, rattled off that Moses refused to be called Pharaoh's, the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He refused that title as a man, as a growing up. So even as a boy, he knew, I don't belong to you. Yes, you're raising me as an Egyptian, you're raising me as Egyptian kings are raised, the whole shebang, all the details. But he refused to be called her son by his own accord, his own decision, as a young man growing up. So he made his stance. I can only speculate why, his mom, his biological mom. She nursed him. I don't know how much she imparted as a baby. I'm not sure how old he was when he was weaned, but there was enough there, enough of a connection, that God made sure that connection stayed strong. Now, Moses probably knew he had an older brother, Aaron, and probably knew he had an older sister, Miriam. Probably knew. As a two-year-old, he may have known that. So he may have had connection with those two as time progressed, as life went on, as years went on. I say that because when Moses kills the Egyptian and flees, Aaron, his brother, comes to him. Well, if they never really met, never really saw each other, never knew each other, Aaron would have no reason to go find Moses. But if they knew and had interaction for years, growing up as young men and older men, and they knew each other well, then yes, they'd have an affection, rejoicing when Aaron sees him. All this connection would be there as a family. So Moses had to have had a strong connection to the Hebrews, even though he was living in Pharaoh's household. Does that make sense? Okay. Yes, go ahead, John.
I don't know if there's any connection to this. Just for when I was looking at chapter 2, verse 15, about Moses in Midian, but he sits down by the well.
Yes.
I was thinking when Yeshua sits down by the well, is this Jacob's well, or is there any connection?
It's funny. It's not Jacob's well. They're totally different locations. I have not considered that connection, whether there was a parallel. When the Bible uses similar terms, similar scenarios, it's trying to make a connection between those two stories. And so I have never explored that. I can't answer the question. That could be. There could be a reason for that particular tie-in, which I do not know about.
Just to go back to Pharaoh's real mother, biological mother, nursing Pharaoh as a baby and perhaps as a young child as well. Biologically, there's a tremendous bonding that goes from the mother and the child to the mother. Both of them are developing these bonding hormones and all that. So you could see real easy how, you know, he becomes very attached to his real mother.
Which would make sense as to why the Egyptian Pharaoh would say, go find a Hebrew woman to nurse as opposed to Egyptian mother to nurse. Yes.
Yeah, if you want to connect when Moses goes to the well, if you want to connect that to a well story, the well story that comes up in my mind is more of the story when Jacob shows up the well that Rachel is coming towards.
Oh.
Now he kind of shows off and, you know.
Yeah, shows his muscles and his strength.
He shows off his muscles and, you know, he moves the stone away so everybody can get the water without having to wait for everybody else to show up first. Well, Moses shows up at this well and there's these shepherds here harassing these young women who are coming to try to water their sheep. He chases those men off so that those women can safely.
Very similar. That's true. That's a good point. That actually, those stories are very, very similar. There's probably a really good, strong connection there. Again, I had not explored it, so I don't know. I'd have to really look into it to whether there's a purpose behind that connection. Yes, Anne.
I wondered why Aaron wasn't killed along with, you know, the midwives back when. But how much older was Aaron then? Just 3 years.
3 years older than Moses. Give or take on their birth dates. It doesn't say how, you know, what day of the year they were born, but they're about approximately 3 years older. I believe Aaron's was born in the summertime. That's what I think it's when he dies, it records the age which he dies and the time which he turns that age. So in the summertime, Aaron was born. So Moses probably, you know, who knows, sometime other than that date. He's about 3 years older. There's a specific reason why Aaron was not killed and he was 3 years older. We'll discuss that today. It's important that he be 3 years older. If he was 2 years older, he'd probably be whacked. He'd be dead. But being 3 years older, he was not. We'll discuss that later today. Any comments or questions? Yes, Carrie.
I encountered an interesting idea this week with a short video that I was watching. And one of the themes that was being highlighted was heroism in Moses' life. And they actually, not to discount anything else, but they actually traced some of that to what they portrayed the Pharaoh's daughter as being heroic, even from pulling him from the water. Because, you know, here she was defying this order from her father and the king of her nation. And so it was just kind of an interesting perspective.
It is interesting. Like I said, if the Egyptian chronology is right, which is, you know, who knows, I got a change of a year, identifying Pharaoh's daughter, the actual one who did it, she is the most shy than Cleopatra herself, most famous female in all Egypt Pharaoh history, for her character, what she did, and how powerful she was. She turned out to be the dominant player in that dynasty period during Moses' lifetime, if it's the right woman. Her stepson from her husband who had a son with another woman, she wound up raising him and ruling over for the first 20 years of his life before she finally passed away and he took over. But she's a very, very important lady, very courageous lady, willing to say, you obey my will, I win, you don't, kind of woman. And as a result, when she goes to her father and says, this is what I did, her father can say what he wants. The kind of character when she was, and how Egypt records her as far as what she did and how she did it, she would have won anyway. Even if he could have all of his guards kill her, she would have said no, the guards would have obeyed her. The kind of woman she was, they knew, don't touch this woman. She's unique. And that was the kind of person she was. It's very important to know that that's kind of household that Moses was raised in. That, hey, you'll be independent, you'll be strong, you'll be self-willed to do what you believe is right. Hence, Moses raising up to see the Egyptian said, well, it's murder to kill him. I'm killing him anyway, because Moses knows it's the right thing to do. The kind of household he was raised in, that's what you would do. Yes?
Is it true that the Egyptians considered the river god, or there's some kind of goddess in the river, that they would think their god was saving Moses?
Probably. I couldn't answer it. The Egyptian pantheon of gods was very extensive and very large. Everything had a god associated with it. There was one Egyptian pharaoh, I forgot his name, starts with an A. Anyway, who converted to monotheism well after Moses had left. What was it? Akhenaten, thank you. Monotheism, he was killed and then Tutankhamun, I think, came after him to convert back to polytheism. So they had many, many different gods. There was only one notable exception that thought there was only one god, and that was it. And everybody else went back to believe multiple gods. So they could have had a god for anything. So I really couldn't answer the question whether it was they thought the river saved them or not. But since there was a god of the river, probably, but they had a god of lots of things. Okay. We have some fun things to talk about today. Fun, relatively, this is relatively speaking. We're not going to go out and have a party, but a few details. So I'm going to take a break in about a little less than 40 minutes from now. So we'll do part one and part two. So the first part we're talking about today will be this part of the Exodus and discussing some details in this story. First of all, starting at chapter one, we discussed a little bit about the details as far as how Pharaoh came to be and who he is and where he came from and how he could have forgotten about Joseph's work. Note it says in the first few verses, well, it's about to verse 8 or so. And by the way, all the boys are dead. Joseph dead. His brothers are dead. That's all done. Verse 8 says, a new king rose over Egypt who did not know of Joseph. This is chapter 1, verse 8. He said to his people, behold, the people of children of Israel are more numerous and stronger than we. Come, let's outsmart it, lest it become numerous, and it may be that if a war will occur, it too may join our enemies and wage war against us and go up from the land. So what specifically is Pharaoh afraid of regarding the children of Israel? There's too many of them. And so there's too many. Yep, too many to rise up against him. Now, to rise up, obviously he's going to take his throne or take his, you know, take the people away if they defeat them, or to leave. Now, this is not an illegitimate fear of Pharaoh. This is not a self-created, delusional thing he invents off the top of his head. They already have a history. Mind you, by the biblical account, this is the dead middle, or about the middle of the 18th dynasty of Egypt. 18th dynasty includes from the tail end, the ending of it near Ramses, the beginning of it near Ahimosis, the start of it. It's many, many, many kings are amongst this dynasty. So the middle of it is about where King Solomon says this occurs. And this one, let's see, I have a stirrup here. How does this work? Oh. There, okay. So in this dynasty, this chart up here, which hopefully you can see most of it, I apologize if you can't see it very clearly. This chart is one of the two dominant theories on the sequence of the pharaohs, which one it is. There's only two dominant theories as far as which pharaoh that Moses was interacting with and how they all started. The old theories of Ramses being the pharaoh during this time has been long since thrown out for almost 300 years. They threw that out a long time ago, realizing it wasn't Ramses because it wouldn't make any sense. This one starts out... Do I have a laser pointer this thing? Oh, I do. Where is the laser pointer? Oh, there it is. Up here is the 18th dynasty of Moses pharaohs. The exit is approximate 1446. This date, 1446 BC, is what King Solomon says it is. Now, he can be off by a year or two, but the point is that's when King Solomon says that the exodus occurs. So Ahimosis starts out the dynasty. He expels the Hyksos, and he oppresses Hebrews, the Hebrew people. Mind you, these dates, these years, most of these years are based on a low chronology, which is just a detail. It doesn't really matter for what we're discussing. But what's important is that first guy, Ahimosis, expels Hyksos. Hyksos, which is, they were a group of foreign kings that ruled Egypt. Foreign kings. They were not Egyptians. They ruled Egypt. They took over Egypt from Egyptian pharaohs in the 12th and 13th dynasties. They took over for about 100 years. And then this guy, Ahimosis, rises up in the city of Thebes and conquers them and kicks them all out. Hyksos are foreign kings. People debate on where they all came from. But it's knowledge that they figure they are Semitic, which means they come from the Canaanite territory. Yes?
That the other day is that they were actually able to take some DNA from the goopy mummies of the pharaohs, and they weren't even Egyptian.
Right. Some of them are not. Some of them are not Egyptian. Now, the Hyksos group people they've determined based on where they, basically archaeology, they're not the most brilliant people, but they're pretty smart what they do. They dug up the cities Hyksos lived in. They found the pottery shards. They are Canaanite make. The Canaanite made pottery and culture and things they did. So they know they are a Semitic-based people. And so they ruled Egypt about 100 years, roughly, something 150, some of that ballpark. They ruled Egypt. But this guy, Ahimosis, kicked them all out. Here's the key, though. They were Semitic, which means they are from the Middle Eastern territory. What are Hebrews? Semitic. So now you have Egyptians who are expelling Semitic people. They got rid of the Hyksos first and to consolidate. But now you have this large chunk of people in a very nice territory of Goshen slash calls called Ramses of the Egypt who are very prosperous and very wealthy. Now, when Ahimosis did this, again, this is based on King Solomon's description, so some can argue whether he was right or wrong. Based on his timing, when Joseph showed up and Joseph came and all the Hebrews came down, they were in the middle of the Hyksos Empire, that time slot, the 100-150 years there. So when Joseph's talking to Pharaoh, it's not an Egyptian pharaoh he's speaking to. It's a Semitic pharaoh he's speaking to. That's where they were discussing and dealing with. Yes.
Is this why he refers to him as pharaoh and king of Egypt?
It could be. There are a lot of different descriptions as far as king of Egypt versus pharaoh and how it's worded. So but when Joseph was dealing with that particular pharaoh, what deal did Joseph make for his family with that particular pharaoh? They would get this territory in this land with their shepherd, their flocks, their herds could grow there. Tax-free territory. Now, when the new Egyptian king comes, biologically Egyptian, gets rid of the Semitic pharaohs because he overpowers them and they have to run away, go home. Is he going to accept or tolerate or recognize this tax-free gift to the Hebrews, whom he just expelled, the people who gave them that tax-free gift? Well, of course not. Our own presidents don't do that. Why would these guys do it? It's just executive order, right? That's all it is. We'll just undo the executive order on day two, right? So it's the same principle. So on the second day, the point is that Ahimos is not going to recognize this detail. So he will start the oppression. And that, okay, Israelite Hebrews, all of Egypt has been enslaved by the previous administration, the previous pharaohs, the previous kings. They've been enslaved in paying taxation of a 20% cut that goes to Pharaoh for every year. Well, now it's going to be upon you. So now he's going to distribute this oppression upon the Hebrews as well. It's pretty typical, pretty normal, nothing very shocking about it. Now, Ahimosis has children as time goes on. This oppression is not a, let's make the executive order and list them all out, and by the end of the first week, we're all enslaved. It didn't work that way. It takes time, progress over you incrementally. Eventually, they're enslaved, and they don't realize what life should be like. So, according to this time, Ahimosis has children. Amenhotep is the first one, Amenhotep the first. This is debated whether Amenhotep the first killed the babies or whether Tutmosis the first killed the babies. No one's really sure because the timing is really, really close on their timing on existence. But Amenhotep has a daughter. Her name is Hatshepsut. You pronounce it Hatshepsut. That's his daughter. Well, yeah, the girl. That's his daughter. She is he has sons also. She has brothers, but this is his daughter. And she winds up having, is one who is supposedly found Moses. This is according to, by the way, strictly according to Solomon's calculations. We get that from when Solomon's dedicating the temple. He says it's been 480 years since he left Egypt. That places the date. We know his date. He built the temple in 966 BC. That's been fixed. We've known that for a long, long, long time. And so based on his 400 years, you got, 1446 BC, 480 years. So so Solomon says when he left the Egypt, this is how we get, it's in the middle of this particular dynasty. That date, the 1446, occurs right toward the tail end of Tutmosis III and the beginning of his son, Amenhotep II. So it's in that time slot. Yes, Sean.
What chapter and verse is that?
King Solomon is 1 Kings. Oh, crud. Did I write that down? I may have forgotten to write that down. He's dedicating the temple. Maybe 2 Kings. Where is it? It's a chapter. Oh, crud. I forgot to write down the address of that one. He's dedicating the temple. It's, let's see, where's 1 or 2 Kings? Let's see. Solomon Reigns of Wisdom, chapter 8 of 1 Kings, or thereabouts. It's somewhere in chapter 8. I don't have the exact address where it is, but you can find it. 1 Kings, I think it's chapter 8, chapter 7 or 8. It should record all of the timings. He's the one who says 480 years. He's not the only one who says it. Other people record different times, different dates, and they're all they all land based on other timings into about a 20-year time slot. To all the Bible, the three locations of the Bible that discuss this, all of them land at about this time of 1446, within a couple of years of each other. So that's about the time slot. So all these men have these things, but the key is that Hatshepsut, that woman, poor lady. I changed my name by then. She's the one who winds up marrying a brother, a stepbrother, Tutmosis II, and wind up having children. He also remarries another girl named Iset, and Iset is the one whom Tutmosis III is the one who comes from, because Hatshepsut does not have any boys. She only has daughters. Moses is her only biological adopted son she has. These are the pharaohs we're dealing with. That's why they have philosophy differences than Joseph and whom Joseph dealt with. These are a different group of pharaohs. These now men are Egyptian pharaohs. The Hebrews, the Hyksos men were Semitic. So there is a racial barrier here that the pharaohs have set up. So this pharaoh would have no knowledge, care, or anything regarding Joseph. It means nothing to him. That's from the previous administration, previous dynasty that has nothing to do with him, who he thought was unfair anyway. So it makes sense why there's no knowledge, no record history between the two characters. They wouldn't care about each other. So new pharaoh, now, not that this king isn't rightfully the king of Egypt, it's just that this is how, you know, the pharaohs worked. So new pharaoh, of course, was Egyptian, did not know Joseph, and he decided to, of course, outsmart them, the people of Israel getting very numerous. So we go through this whole process of all these various generations. So these various kings, pharaohs, they don't rule for very long periods of time. Each pharaoh rules about, you know, average 15 to 25 years. Pretty typical. So it's not like, so one person can live through three or four pharaoh administrations. Yeah, it's not, yeah, look at Elizabeth, 60 years, you're forever. No, it's short periods of time that these men come. Because they don't take pharaohhood, if you take that term, until their fathers are dead. And then they only live for a very short period of time anyway, before they're either killed or they die of one other disease that happens to them, whatever it may be. So it's pretty short turnover time when it comes to pharaohs are concerned. So you can live, a person could be born at Ahimosis' time and then be dead by the time Tutmosis III takes the throne. Well, you've gone through, you know, four pharaohs by the time Tutmosis III shows up and is born. So you can go through a lot of people. So laws, you can see and watch them progressively get worse and worse and worse with each new pharaoh. You yourself see it. You see, if it was such that you would live and a pharaoh lives, like the kings of Israel, who most of them ruled longer periods of time, you might live through two of them at most. So kings of Israel, longer stretches than the kings of Pharaoh, the Pharaoh kings were. In Israel, you may be born under an oppressive administration, oppressive king. You wouldn't know life better than that. And you would just see, okay, this is how life is. And you live your whole life, this is oppression, and you die oppressed. That's life, that's existence. Well, being in this, a shorter time span of life, not only you see the difference, your parents, your children are all living under new, more restrictive, more difficult laws. The burdens become more and more harsh, more cruel, more hardship upon you and your family. Does that make sense? So this pharaoh, of course, sees they're all getting big and there are too many of them. They're going to rise up and attack me. Mind you, remember, they are Semitic. And Egypt is constantly fighting the Semitic peoples, the Amalekites, the Midianites, all the Canaanite territories. There's always constant war. So it's not this pharaoh who's rising up to kill the babies isn't unaware or creating his fictitious thought in his mind these people are going to fight against him. Mind you, the Hebrew people are Semitic as far as he's concerned. They're from Canaan. That's where they came from. And the people he's fighting are also Canaanites. And so he's always battling and fighting against. And the Hittites too. So as far as he's concerned, they are one and the same groups of people. There's no real differences. And you can do a few different things. You can either befriend your enemy, you can oppress your enemy, you can expel your enemy, or kill your enemy. He did not choose to befriend them. So you got, you know, expulsion, oppressing, and killing. He didn't choose to kill them either. So the only left is oppress them or expel them. He didn't want them expelled because they're very valuable as human beings and slave labor. He tried to oppress. Those are the many options he has. That's what he did. Nothing too shocking about it, but this is the sequence in which he took place. I'm going to go through another slide. Let's see. Where's my little remote control? There it is. Because there's somebody else who I'm sure everybody here has recognized as a similar type of pharaoh. We've all seen it many times and talked about it over the years. These are different pharaoh dates and such. There's been different kingdoms and ideas. I'm going to go to this one. Recognize these two men? One says Pharaoh. The other side says Herod. Now, King Herod, if you remember, he has a somewhat similar decree, right? What was the decree that's similar between these two pharaohs? Killing the babies, right? We've heard that before. Now, King Herod was the most one of the most cruel kings of the Roman Empire of his day. Even the Caesars said, holy cow, that guy's crazy. That's the stuff he did. They didn't use those words. They used other words. They were actually better puns. They said it's better to be a huyo versus a huso in Herod's household. Better be a pig than a son. Because at least Herod won't kill and eat the pigs. He'll kill his sons, but not the pigs. So that was Caesar Augustus said that because Herod was so awful. So Pharaoh does a few things. We have some history about him, but Herod does somewhat similar things in his lifetime. Our Bibles only record a small snippet about King Herod the First. Little bits about him, not very much. But he is one of the most documented kings in all of human history. There is more stuff about him than almost any king who ever lived. With the exception of the modern kings, the ones in the 1800s, 19, there's a lot of written about them, there's volumes, but as far as ancient history, he has many, many chapters and books written about him in multiple cultures because he was so unique, so gruesome, so cruel, and so powerful, and so dynamic of a person that everybody wanted to write about him. He was a unique character. There's lots of stuff about him. It's not recorded all in our Bible, so I wasn't going to discuss all of it. It wasn't important to the content of what Messiah's birth was, because it tore the tail end of Herod's life. But Herod took a lot of things. There's certain similarities. I have these broken up here. Jeff greatly formatted it for me. Thank you, sir. Because mine was really ugly looking. So you can see what some of the comparisons. So here's a Pharaoh, Ahimosis the First, he took the throne by force, expelling the foreign Semitic Hyksos at the time when she took the throne. Well, Herod, when he took the throne, did the same thing. He took the throne by force, killing the Hasmoneans and expelling the Parthians. They both use the same method. Now, for those of you who don't know who Hasmoneans are and Parthians are another country, another group of people that were further east of Rome, the Roman Empire. They were always battling, fighting back and forth. Same like Egypt, always fighting the Canaanites back and forth. There's always constant battle. The Parthians and Romans, always constant battle, always the opportunity to try to kill each other off. That's what they did. Now, when Herod took the throne, now, to be fair, it was General Pompey that actually did the work. He took the Israel territory, and then he gave it to Herod's dad. Herod's dad split Israel in half, gave half to Herod, half to the other son. Herod took the Galilee kingdom, and his other son, which I forgot the guy's name, Herod's brother, it's something like Phileas or something like that, or Phileas. Anyway, took Judea, but Herod winds up, due to a series of wars, takes the whole territory, killing and expelling everybody off. He is interested in particularly killing off the Hasmoneans, which is the people who are the royal family of Israel, who are also obedient to God's instructions and words. This procedure was not shocking, but that's what Herod did. So he forced killing as many of them as he could, the Hasmonean kings. He was pretty gruesome about it. I won't go into all the details. He also got rid of the Parthians out of the territory of Israel, pushed him back further east. Now, the second similarity is Pharaoh of Egypt. Pharaoh was Egyptian. He did not know Joseph. We just discussed this because Joseph was of the Hyksos people, the different Semitic groups. Herod was Edomite. He did not obey the laws of God under the Hasmonean rules. So even though those of you who are familiar with it, the term that Herod being what they call loosely half Jewish, they commonly call it half Jewish. Well, they call him half Jewish. He really wasn't. They call him half Jewish. All Edomites at the time of Herod were called half Jewish because the Hasmoneans had dominated and conquered them and said, here are your new set of laws, Edomites. You will now obey this set. And so they all had to obey the same laws that their conquerors told them to obey. So they were not biologically Jewish, but they knew all the laws of the Israelite laws. So they had to obey them because that's what the captors, the Hasmoneans, the kings of Israel, had said, you will now do this. That's why they were half Jewish. Half by practicing, they knew what the laws were, but their heart and belief in biology wasn't in it. It was just by an oppressive, I have to do this, so I do this. He was biologically wholly Edomite. So where all the kings at his time, his sons eventually, because he did marry Jewish women. He had 10 wives. Married Jewish women, and amongst them, many of them were Jews. His children were a blended mix of Jewish and Edomite, but he himself was wholly Edomite. He didn't obey the laws of God. He doesn't have the same association, like Pharaoh, he didn't have the same association with Joseph and what Joseph did. Herod's not the same association with Hasmoneans, what Hasmoneans did. Because Herod doesn't care how the Hasmoneans got there. How did they get there? The Maccabees. He doesn't care about the Maccabees. He doesn't care about how they got where they're at, because he was against them to begin with. Meaning his ancestry, his Edomites, would be against the Jews to begin with. So he's not thrilled, like, oh, yay, the Hasmoneans, you conquered us. No. Say, I hate your guts. I'd like to have you all drop dead. And so he did that. He killed them, most of them off. He's pretty good at it. So much of it was just Pharaoh did not recognize the territory given the Hebrews for their rule of their own affairs and maintain their own area. He did not recognize that when he took it over, because that was done by the previous administration. Well, Herod had his own set of rules. He also took over and took over the governing of Israel under the Sanhedrin. He started out by killing them all off, save one man, and then rebuilt them under his own tutelage. You will now obey my laws. So the Sanhedrin was now under his authority, and they did whatever he told them to do. He killed a lot of them to maintain their fear to do so, and Pharaoh did very similarly. And of course, Pharaoh enslaves the Semitic Hebrews with, we just read about this, great cruelty, and discusses the great crushing hardness. Well, Pharaoh enslaves a different type of people, because the Pharaoh was enslaving the Semitic Hebrews, fearing they would join his enemies and take the throne. Well, King Herod, the Roman Empire's most cruel king up to that point, conspired to murder all of his family and the leadership before him. That was his objective. Now, it's like, well, these are kind of similar. Actually, they're very similar. When Pharaoh does his work in here in Exodus, who is he interacting with? Well, most when Moses is talking to him, but before when he's enslaving them, who are the people that he's actually enslaving? He's whipping the taskmasters? Exactly. He's whipping and attacking the leaders. He doesn't whip and attack every slave. That's not worth it. Whip and attack leaders. He focuses attention on them, because who would take the throne if they were going to fight? The leaders would. Who would tell the people, go join the enemy? The leaders would. So who does Pharaoh attack? Who does Pharaoh oppress? The leaders. Herod did the same thing. He conspired to murder his whole family. He wiped out he married his first wife, who, I won't go into the details of all the details behind her, but Pharaoh had already expelled her dad, kicked him off to Parthia, so you must leave before we kill you. So he runs away. He marries his father-in-law's daughter, and so she's under the king rule. She has no choice in the matter. He murders her younger brother. He drowns him because he didn't like him. Disagree with what he was doing. Her younger brother was the high priest at the time. He drowned him in the process. And then he brought, by convincing argument, who her father-in-law was a very peaceable, kind, soft-spoken man, convinced him to come back to Israel, say, hey, I'll have a good place for you, be safe and secure. His goal was to keep an eye on him so he can kill him, which he did. So continuing on, Pharaoh focuses attention, of course, on killing the leadership of the family who would have right to the throne. Pharaoh focuses attention on wiping out or authority pressing the leadership of the Israelites so they would never take the throne. Continuing on, Pharaoh builds cities by the slaves, Pithon and Ramses. Now, mind you, Ramses it's the same name as Goshen. It says that they occupied the land of Goshen. It's the Bible says over and over again, the land of Goshen. But it's also called, in Egyptian, the land of Ramses. It's the same name, the same place, two different names. Makes sense? Goshen is not the Egyptian word, that's the Semitic word for it. Ramses is the Egyptian name for that same plot of land. Okay? And the king Ramses was named many, many years later after that same plot of land. Ramses the first and second, that was a long time later. So it's a territory. So he built Pithom, which is a city, and he also built Ramses, a city within that territory, that little spot they were all dwelling in. He could have called the built Goshen, made no difference. That's what he had him rebuild. Herod similarly built also cities. In his technique, he did extreme taxation upon the Israelites. Thank you for correcting Caesarea's spelling, because I misspelled it on my earlier. He built Caesarea and, of course, the temple of God, and lots and lots and lots of idols. Now, Herod spent lots of money doing this, and he was beyond his financial means, so he taxed the people extremely so to do this, in order to fulfill this technique. What did Pharaoh do? He didn't use money taxation, he used labor taxation. He made the people enslave them to do the work. Much like what Solomon did, exactly. Though Solomon, I think, was a little bit kinder. He didn't kill him for it. A little bit. He gave a few months off. There's vacation time. There are a lot of similarities. But I want to point attention to the details. Pharaoh built the slaves' labor, the Pithon of Ramses, which is cities, nothing fancy about them, building bricks and such. Herod, who was from Edom, he knew all the laws, because the Hasmoneans imposed them upon Edomites as well, of the rules. Look what things he built, though. What's this right here? This is idols. Herod built lots and lots of idols. He put a huge golden eagle directly on top of the gates to the temple of God. Massive golden eagle, so we would worship this golden eagle. So that he was told at the time, you can't do that. You already know the laws are against it. And Herod said, I will kill you now. And so he did. So you don't point out Herod's mistakes. You die for that. So you best just say, yes, sir, Herod, and walk away and hope he doesn't kill you in the back. So that's pretty much, because he was a really awful man. He does worse, but he's a scary man. You don't deal with him. You don't interact with him. So it's just a mismatch between these two men. Now, Pharaoh, this is his son, continued on, ordered the midwives to kill the Semitic boys. Now, it's debated whether Amenhotep did it or whether his son, Tutmosis I, did it. We're not really sure, but it's about the same time slot. This is where I want to bring your attention to, which is a character parallel. We can look at the Torah portion. You see, these midwives, why are they there? The story can continue on as if they weren't even there. It's like this insert of these two women who do this work and ignore Pharaoh and they move on as if it wasn't even there. A strange part of the story. They're there for a reason. Yes, Don.
Was that eagle that you were talking about just previously here, was that the eagle that the zealots tore down and many of them were...
Yes, that was the one. Yes. Well, because they thought Herod had died. They said, great, he's dead, tear it down. But he wasn't actually dead yet. And they, oh, crud. And so he arrested them all and whacked them all. They're all dead. He killed them for it. So it was bad timing. If they just waited a few more months, it wouldn't have been a problem, but they got the wrong message. It's important to get your facts straight, bottom line. If you get your facts wrong, bad things happen. So you got to get them right. He wasn't dead yet, and so he killed them for it. He was almost dead. He was like almost 70 at the time. Anyhow, Pharaoh ordered the midwives to kill Semitic boys. This is what I bring your attention. These two women. Now, what is the function of a midwife? To deliver a baby, right? To bring from what isn't alive, well, isn't out living amongst people, to what is out living amongst people. Yes, they're alive. I'm not going into abortion details. Side note, no. We're just saying, bring a baby out to what is alive, right? That's the point. To bring them part of the living and active and part of the world. To birth them. That's their function. Herod runs across a few individuals where Messiah is born. The individuals were Parthian Magi kingmakers. Now, Parthian religion stated that no Parthian king could be king unless the Magi or Magoi anointed them as king. Magi or Magoi, you can pronounce it a lot of different ways. It's a Semitic word with Greek translation. Anyway, Magi or Magoi, it's same difference. They're the ones who decide, is this person king-worthy or are they not? If they're not king-worthy, the Parthian king say, well, okay, try my next son. Try the next one. Try the next one. The Magi say, that one's good enough, he'll be king. So they are kingmakers. That's their job. That's really their only task in existence, is to make kings or not make kings. So when they come, and Herod knows who these people are, mind you, he just expelled a bunch of Parthians earlier. He's not shocking. These aren't a new culture, new people, never heard of them before. He knows what their job is. They come to Herod and say, hey, there's a new baby born. We saw his star. We have to anoint him as king. Now, Herod, who has spent his years killing as many of the people who he thought might want kingship over and over and over again, killing them off, and now these guys come and say, we're going to anoint him to the king. Okay, who is he? I got to kill this one too. So he's got a work ahead of him. Yes, Jared.
So should the song go, we three kingmakers of Orient are?
It doesn't say there were three. There could have been 20, it could have been 100. Who knows? I don't know how many there were. They had three gifts, but I don't know how many there actually were. And they're kingmakers is what their job was. They weren't actually kings themselves. So, Herod's job, okay, he spent lots of effort. He was very diligent in killing as many kings as he could. And so here's one more to have to kill. Herod is an old man at this time. He's roughly around 70 years old, give or take. I don't know his exact birth date. Now, according to records, he is unable to walk. He's bedridden, or couch-ridden, as they call it, because they carried his couch around. The same difference. He had worms coming out of him, pooling of water, liquid on the ground underneath him at all times. He knew he was dying at the time these guys show up. Yeah, why waste his time? Exactly. Why would you care? Who cares you die? Because Herod has sons. Herod wants his sons to be king and make sure this usurper gets whacked quickly. Now, so obviously, Herod wants this guy dead, just like Pharaoh would want the Semitic boys dead. Now, because both of them, Pharaoh's afraid the Semitic boys will take the throne. Well, Herod's afraid this Semitic boy is going to take the throne. So both have the same exact fear, very similarly. Pharaoh, of course, tells the midwives to kill the boys. Now, he doesn't go out and announce it. Hey, everybody, I told the midwives, go kill all your sons. Does he? No, because would they allow the midwives in their households? Of course, it's a secret. What does Pharaoh do? He instructs them, lead the way so I can worship him too. Is he telling them, so I can kill him too? No, it's a secret. The point is, what did the midwives do? They feared God. And they didn't go there. And they went and God blessed them with houses of their own. What did the Magi do? They heard the voice of God saying, don't go back to Pharaoh and go home. Go to your house. The midwives have houses. Go to your house under its own, bypassing Herod. Do not follow Herod's instructions, which was to come back and tell him about it, rather just flee and run. Of course, obviously, we get the story that Messiah's parents, they take off too from the same instructions. So both of them disobey. The midwives disobey Pharaoh, and the Magi disobey Herod, and they both return home to their own respective places. And God blesses, obviously, both of them. Now, in most cases, Herod's life was unique. They concealed him from Pharaoh for roughly 3 months old. Their job was to conceal him so Pharaoh wouldn't find out he's alive, wouldn't find out he exists. Well, in Yeshua's parents' case, we're also warned and concealed Yeshua from Herod, but not in a basket. They brought him down to Egypt. Either way, they're both being separated out or concealed from Pharaoh, concealed from Herod. The point of these two men is to watch and see the similarities. There's more. So, Pharaoh's solution to the midwife disobeying him was kill all the male boys, not including Aaron, who was 3 years old. Because Aaron's 3 years old this time, he was not being included. But he told his soldiers or whoever else he was commanded to, kill all the male boys of the Israelites, not his own people. Herod took a similar solution with the same age group. Killing the boys, Herod orders kill the boys in Bethlehem under the age of 2, based on his timing when the Magoi said this is about when they saw the star, this is with the similarities. I say the 2 is important, that if you're under 2 years old, you were killed in Herod's time. But Herod, being 3 years old, was not killed in Pharaoh's time. That would imply the 3-year-old is the threshold, or somebody 2-year-old or older was not included in the killing process, either with Herod and probably either with Pharaoh too. So Pharaoh probably killed boys who were under the age of 2 and just knocked them all off. Similar to what Herod's solution was. Probably similar. I say this because we see there's a lot of parallels between these two men and their solutions, how they solve the world around them, the people around them, and they have very similar solutions for all their problems. Because they're so similar, it's probably almost identical, and on purposefully, it's similar. Now, Herod's killing of boys at 2 years old in Bethlehem, it was probably about 20 boys total, roughly. Bethlehem at this time has about 1,500 population, give or take. The number says under the age of 2 is only about 30 or so kids. 30 people be under the age of 2. Half them girls, half boys. You have about 15 boys. And he also carried an area around it. So this event in Herod's life that was enormous in our scripture reading is a minor blip in the number of people he's murdered. It's almost insignificant. That's the story. It's a story of Rachel mourning for her children. Herod has killed these children. It accomplishes that prophecy. But it's not like Herod killed millions of kids, or even tens of thousands, or even hundreds. It's a small number. How many did Pharaoh kill? I don't know. Probably more, but I don't know. But this is a small number of group. It wasn't any less evil. It's still equally evil, but he might have thought a massive scope of pools of blood of little babies. There's a few kids killed. Now, I say that because this event of Herod is only recorded by Matthew. No one else records it. No other historian records it. No other gospel records it, because it's a minor detail of the number of things that Herod did. Yeah, it's like us writing about Obama stubbing his toe. Who cares? It wouldn't matter, because he's done so many other things. It wouldn't matter. Or any other dictator, or Hitler, he had tennis elbow. Okay. I don't care if he had tennis elbow. Look what he did in life. So you can deal with the small things, how small they are, though maybe big to some people. It's very small compared to the scope of how evil this person truly was. This event is not recorded anywhere other than Matthew. But still, it's recorded for our knowledge and understanding that this is how the prophecy about Rachel weeping for her children is accomplished, is this story, this part of the story. It's part of Messiah's life and how he survived. So continuing on, Moses, of course, delivered by execution by Pharaoh's daughter, Hashbit, which is between 10 to 15 years old. This is another detail of Pharaoh that is recorded, which we should know about, because this is how Pharaoh's daughter plays in Moses' life, and how Herod has his own version of Pharaoh's daughter in his life. There are still similarities. Now, for those who don't know the history of Herod, a few weeks before he dies, he orders all the head household, all the leaders of every household. That means every household, not like, you know, a tribal leader, but no. Every single structure, physical home, has a male in charge of it. He orders every one of them to go to Jericho. This is a few weeks before he dies, about a week or so before he dies. All go to Jericho, and they go. He locks them up in the Hippodrome, which is the horse racing track stadium. And he orders his sister, Salome, when I die, I know all of Israel will rejoice and celebrate, because they want me dead. They love to see me dead. I want them to mourn instead. So when I die, kill everybody inside that stadium so that every household has somebody they can mourn when I die. Make sure they all feel bad when I die too. That was his objective. And he had her swear she would do it. No exceptions, making sure all these men would die. We got thousands of people stuck in this horse track stadium with guards out, so they can't get out. They don't know why they're there, other than they were told they'd be killed. They didn't show up. But so Herod's ordered them all to be killed. Herod, of course, eventually dies a few days later. But this is where I want to bring your attention to. Pharaoh had ordered all the babies killed, but his daughter, his own relative, Hashbit, saved one. Herod's sister, after he died, she opened the hippodrome and said, everybody, go home. Go home. She didn't do it. Go home. So Herod's sister, whom he trusted, he executed his own wife by this time. He executed a lot of his own sons already. So he didn't trust anybody except his own sister. But she said, I'm not going to do this to my dead brother. Go home. She sent them all home. So it tells us that even Pharaoh, who has this one daughter who is more stubborn than he is and won't fulfill the requirements, it shows even King Herod has one, in this case, the sibling who is younger than him, who also is just as stubborn and said, I'm not going to do this. I won't obey your orders. So even both kings had their same character in their stories about how this took place and delivered someone. In this case, of course, Salome delivered a whole lot of people. And Herod, of course, Hashbit only delivered one. But still, the principle is the same. Of course, we end with Moses being adopted as the firstborn of Thutmose II, which, of course, he only had daughters with Hashbit, which is one of his wives. He's the firstborn son. He is the oldest. So he should be the new Pharaoh king. After Thutmose II dies, Moses becomes the new king, new Pharaoh. That's adoption rules. That's how it would work out. Yeshua, of course, becomes obviously the heir to God's throne because all the other kings are dead. Herod killed them all off. There's nobody left but Yeshua anyway. The rest of them are all been whacked. So it's pretty straightforward how these similarities are unique in how that these are parallel to each other in these two men's lives. So we learned a lot about Pharaoh, a lot about Herod, and how similar these two characters are and why our Bible connects them. Makes sense why they're connected? Makes sense why it's recorded? Now, a lot of stuff is not recorded in our Bibles regarding Herod. It's recorded in other texts, which Josephus has tons and tons of it. A lot of other books have also written about it as well. We're going to read one more portion. We'll take a break, and then we'll come back and continue on with our second part, too. So our break, I'm going to read a portion of our Haftorah, because this explains a little bit more about the nature of Herod and King and Pharaoh as well. After we go to Isaiah chapter 27. Not the entire chapter, mind you. Just part of it. Isaiah 27, jumping to verse 6. Of Isaiah 27, verse 6. This explains a little bit more about the nature of men, who we're dealing with, what kind of person Pharaoh, what kind of person Herod is, and what God thinks about these men. So Isaiah chapter 27, verse 6. The days are coming when Jacob will take root and Israel will bud and blossom and fill the face of the earth like fruit. Did he strike him as he struck those who struck him? Was he slain like the slaying of his enemies? According to his measure of sin, he contended against her farmland, stripping it with his harsh wind on the day of the east wind. Therefore, through this shall Jacob's iniquity be atoned, and for all this shall the fruit of his sins be removed. When he makes all the altar stones like the ground chalk stones, and asher trees and sun idols will arise no more. The fortified cities will be lonely, habitations of depopulated and forlorn like the wilderness. There a calf will graze, and there will lie consumed its branches. When its boughs wither, they will break, and women will come and set it aflame, for it is not a nation of understanding. Therefore its maker will not show it mercy, its creator will not be gracious to it. It shall be on that day the Lord will thresh from the surging river to the brook of Egypt, and you will be gathered up one by one, children of Israel. It shall be on that day that a great shofar will blow, and those who are lost in the land of Assyria and those who are cast away in the land of Egypt will come, and they will prostrate themselves to the Lord on the holy mountain of Jerusalem. This is a characterization of obviously the people of Israel. This is where Herod and chapter 28, where Herod and Pharaoh come in. Woe to the crown pride of Ephraim's drunkards. The delight of his glory is a fading blossom. It is a valley of oil upon the head of those battered by wine. Behold, my Lord has a strong and powerful wind, like a downpour of hail, a destructive tempest, like a downpour of mighty surging waters. He will lay to the ground that crown with his hand, trod underfoot with the crown of pride of Ephraim's drunkards, and the withering blossom. The delight of his glory that is like a valley of oil upon his head will be like a fig that ripens before summer. As soon as an observer sees it, what is yet in his hand, he swallows it. All that the Lord, Master of Legions, will be crowned of delight in a diadem of glory for the remnant of his people, and a spirit of judgment for those who sit in judgment, and a source of strength for those who return from war to the gate. For they too have erred because of wine and strayed because of liquor. The priest and his false prophet have erred because of liquor and were corrupted by wine, and they have strayed because of liquor and erred in vision, perverted their justice. For all tables are full of vomit, filth, with no clean place. To whom shall each one teach knowledge? To whom shall one explain a message? To those weaned from mother's milk, remove the breasts, for it is commandment by commandment, line by line, and line by line, here and there. For as with unintelligible speech and in another tongue does one speak to this nation, though he tells them, this is the true rest, give us rest this weariness, and this is the true satisfaction, yet they would not listen, not be content to listen. The word of the Lord shall befall them commandment by commandment, line by line, bit by here, bit in there. So they shall go and stumble backward and be broken and be tripped and caught. This section of the Torah portion helps us to explain, understand the nature how God sees the men like Pharaoh and like Herod and their people who are working with them. Though they have, their mind is not clear, like a drunkard would not be clear, not clear thinking. Because how many of you have read the story of Pharaoh and say, why on earth did he not just give up? What's, come on, can't you see Egypt's lost? 10 times? Come on. Exactly. Because a drunkard is stubborn and stupid. That bottom line. You can't think straight. You're so blind what's going on around you. You can't see what's happening here. And so, much like, so we see the example in the Haftorah reading that Pharaoh and Herod, similarly, was Herod clear thinking? Of course not. He was a rotten, evil human being. So was Pharaoh, rotten, evil person. So we learn that these men are like a drunk man. They are no comprehension, no understanding, no comprehension of what they're doing or why they're doing it. They're just doing it because that's what drunkards do. So it makes sense. And what does God do with them? He's going to crush it. And what did he do with these men? He crushed them. So we discussed the details of Pharaoh and Herod. But now there's other stuff in the Torah portion that we need to know about and why it's there. Because it affects us and explains certain details that otherwise are almost unexplainable. I say almost because if you really worked at it, you could figure it out. But the Torah portion has other things in it. We're outside of chapter 1 of Exodus. Because that was chapter 1 of part 1. Exodus. Back to Exodus again. Back to the book of Exodus. So we discussed our details of chapter 1 of Exodus. Now we're going to chapter 2 and 3 and 4, 5 and 6. Well, not only 6, it's like one verse. But 3, 4 and 5. 2, 3, 4. I asked this question to my children last night, which I wasn't going to bring up today, but I decided anyway because I can. So let's pretend for a moment. Rose is king. She's king of everything. The whole world, absolute monarchy, she owns everything, does everything. Everything, we have to obey her. Now, she makes a law. I won't tell you what the law is. She makes a law, and you are a citizen of this kingship. You have to obey the king, everybody else will be the king. Now, you see in this law, there is a child being punished due to this law. A child, a young child. What do? Do you obey the king's law? You hide the child? Did you hide the child? Now, I didn't tell you if the law was right or wrong. It just made a law, and you see a child being punished. You decide, what do you do? Ah, same thing. This is a question my children had. This is a discussion we had last night. Now, let's say an adult is being punished. Now, the law was not right or wrong. I'm not saying what the law is. But you see, an adult is suffering from this law. You're not, but an adult is. What do you do? Do you intervene? I mean, by doing so, you're breaking the law, because there's no law against this punishment was happening. Do you intervene or do you not intervene? Now, I didn't tell him the law was right or wrong. Maybe this person was a wicked evildoer and a sorcerer. He's being whipped for it. Well, that would say, oh, well, that's a good law. What if this person was, in your mind, not doing anything wrong, but being punished for it? He's, well, that's a bad law. I'm not discussing whether the law is good or bad. When you are a citizen, what do you do? How do you determine? What do you decide to do? What makes you act versus not act? Those are discussions we have to discuss and think about when we come across things. Yes, Daniel. That's what your lawyer tells you. Can I get away with this or not? When we're discussing details, we have to decide how this works. Now, when a law is not illegal. Somebody's doing it, and it's not against the law. It's perfectly acceptable to do something that you perceive is harmful or not good. But according to the law, they're doing right. They're doing correctly. They're obeying it. That's the third scenario. What do you do? So, what I discuss with my children is this. When we're discussing what we do and don't do, regarding laws, whether they're right or wrong, you always must compare them. What would God do? What did he say to do? That determines what your actions are to be. Regardless if the law is good in someone's eyes or bad in someone's eyes. You're conscious of God's laws. Okay, wait a minute. Is this acceptable? What do I do? Because sometimes, in the case of Moses' parents, the law was kill the child. What'd they do? They disobeyed the law. Was it right in God's eyes? Of course. In Pharaoh's and Egypt's eyes, it would not be. Yes, Daniel.
So they did what they thought was right according to their
understanding,
with the knowledge that they may be reaping the consequences of violating the civil law.
Correct, correct. They had to accept these responsibilities. Oh, yes. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, what do you make of Governor Brown making California a sanctuary state and God sets it on fire? And now there's earthquakes starting again.
Certain things may or may not be within our realm of activity, but these are the things we discuss and things we have to deal with of moral and righteous consequence. And they are important to think about because Moses deals with them. Moses' parents deal with them. What would we do? Yes, Larry?
When we were reading earlier, it occurred to me, although this is a minor point, no use talking about it, but now when you're talking about this, they actually did obey Pharaoh's law. They threw him into the river.
Hey, good point. Good deal. You're right. They did. He did obey Pharaoh's law. They threw him into the river. In a basket that wouldn't sink, but still they threw him in. Technicality, that's where the lawyer comes in. Thank you, Daniel. What would your lawyer say? Yes, Dan.
But the most important thing is they feared Yahweh.
They
didn't fear that Pharaoh, and they didn't fear death. They would rather obey God, and they feared God before. They didn't let men scare them.
And willing to accept the consequence. That's important. So when Moses comes across this Egyptian whipping a slave to the point of near death or dying, he checks because you know he's watching, but he kills Egyptian. Now, that's murder. It is not unacceptable for the Egyptian to kill the slave. It's perfectly acceptable. Go right ahead. Egyptian law, it's acceptable. It's not acceptable for Moses to kill the Egyptian for it. That's murder. So Moses broke the Egyptian law by killing the Egyptian, who was not breaking the law, who was not doing anything wrong according to the law. He was obeying it fully, completely, and thoroughly. No problems. Moses went outside the law, killing someone because he compared not this act to Pharaoh's law, but this act to God's law. There's a righteousness of man and righteousness of God. They are not the same thing. Yes, Jared.
Would it have been a completely different scenario if he had told the slave master to stop being the slave?
No, because even that, you can't. You he's not your slave. Now, Moses at this time, when this occurs, Moses the third is already born. So Moses no longer has rights to the throne. He knows he's no longer going to be king. He's not a biological descendant. So he has no right as Pharaoh would have. If Moses still was a little younger, maybe he would have order to do something. But this case is not the case. So he can tell the man, don't beat the slave. The man has no obligation to hear or even consider Moses' words. None. He can even warn him. That's premeditated murder. There's no obligation for the Egyptian to obey. So when Moses deals with this issue, the man isn't breaking the law. Moses takes upon himself to say, hey, this law is not against you, the Egyptian, because it's perfectly acceptable for you to do this. But I compare the law against God's law, and I'm willing to accept the consequences of what happens here. He then strikes and hides the body. Now, of course, obviously, someone tells. Word gets out, Pharaoh finds out, and Pharaoh seeks to kill Moses for it. Why? Because he murdered someone. The Egyptian didn't do anything wrong as far as Pharaoh's concerned, but Pharaoh believes and perceives, Moses, you are now a murderer. Unjustified murder. Yes?
I got a couple of clarifying points here. So was this the eye for an eye justification that Moses was doing when he killed him?
Nope. A man is not killed unless he kills someone. So beating someone to death is strictly forbidden in the Torah, unless they are a murderer already. So unless he has killed someone, you cannot kill someone. No execution is permitted. That's the law of God. And God said, by man's blood, man shall shed. He shed someone's blood. You are not, so there's no death penalty for robbery, no death penalty for beating somebody up. No death penalty for stealing things, whatever you want, embezzlement. You cannot kill someone for that. But if they take a life, you can. So in Moses' case, he perceived the Egyptian was about to, in the process of killing this Hebrew slave to death. to kill him. Which, mind you, at this time and place in history, it doesn't take a lot to kill you. There is no emergency room. There is no reconstructive surgery. You break a bone, it's broken forever. They tried, but they really wasn't that good at their medical ability. So it doesn't take much to kill somebody. So this man's being beaten by the Egyptian. He perceives you're beating this man to death to kill him. That is your objective. Now, I wasn't there. I couldn't see the look on the Egyptian's face. I don't know what he looked like or how intent, what his anger was, none of that stuff. But Moses did. Moses perceived, I must prevent this murder. So I'm going to strike the murderer or the attempted murderer in this process. That's how that would work. God strictly forbids executing somebody who is not executing or trying to execute somebody else. You don't murder someone. You don't murder someone unless they have actually murdered somebody else. That's how it's supposed to work. Yes.
So the other point of clarification is, well, obviously in that position he couldn't, but wouldn't the Torah also say that then you need to bring him in front of the judges and try to get them to
correct.
Basically repent?
It's a trial. The Torah requires a trial to how this is supposed to work. Now, mind you, in this is Egyptian law. What would the trial come out to? Under Egyptian law. Well, if the Egyptian was allowed to continue on his process unabated and kill the Hebrew, and Moses tried to bring charges against him, what would the charges be? There aren't any. So Moses is, with inside his own mind, struggling with these problems in his head. Now, you and I would also struggle with similar problems. Do I intervene? Do I not? And Moses is deciding. He's making a decision. Do I intervene? Do I not intervene? Do I stop the Egyptian? Do I back off and say, hey, it's legally right, acceptable to do so? Moses chose to prevent the murder by killing the assaulter, killing the Egyptian instead. No. He grows up with a concept of what is right and what is wrong. The Torah from Moses was not given yet, but he understands a basic understanding of what is right and what is wrong from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their understanding of what God would consider acceptable and what is not acceptable.
This is, even though the physical Torah wasn't given until Mount Sinai, there were still Torah given, and even Adam in the garden.
Right, there were certain instructions, but not detailed as far as circumstances which you do and don't execute somebody. Those are not given, those are detailed out in the Torah itself. But the idea of how a man do not shed man's blood unless that man has shed another man's blood. That law, that principle, has always been there. That's been around since Cain and Abel. So we know that. And Moses knows that much information because he grew up with a basic understanding of how life worked. So he knows certain things. He does not know the details of what is clean and unclean about all. That's given much, much, much later. So we'll discuss that later when that time comes. So he has a basic moral understanding of God. By man's blood, man's blood need to be shed, and you don't shed man's blood unless he's shed somebody else's blood. Yes.
Sorry, so where did he get this moral concept? Was it not told to him by his mother? This is where I'm kind of getting at.
This is a great question.
The Holy Spirit hit him, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's a great question. I discussed with, I think it was Louise early on when we first started out. How did Moses understand or realize he wasn't Egyptian? He had to have interaction with the Hebrews. There had to be some. Because his brother knew him, his sister knew him, they knew of him, and they interacted with him, and Aaron went out to go seek him, to find him, and rejoice when he found him. So they had to have known each other. And Moses was 80 years old at the time, roughly, when Aaron comes to meet him. So a long time has lapsed. If you had lost your brother for 80 years, would you remember what he looked like? No. Did you know what he was? No. Would you even know his name? Probably not. But if you saw him every day or every week or on a regular basis and talked to him and interacted with him and discussed and talked about things as you grew up and lived your lives, after 80 years of interacting with him and he's been gone for a long time, you'd rejoice to see him again. So obviously Moses and Aaron had to have known each other very, very well along their lives. Moses even knew he had a brother. That's good. Moses also had a responsibility to his own tribes. His belief, he believed he was Hebrew. Excuse me. The book of Hebrews discussed that Moses refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, refused the title, refused it of his own accord. So he knew that there was something out there in his tribes that he belonged to. He would have had to attach and know what they thought, what they believed, why they thought it, why they believed it, and the most important part, they were going to be delivered at some point by someone. He would have known that because that they're all waiting for. They all would have talked about it relentlessly. Talked, somehow we're going to get this. Somehow we have to get it. Somehow we know this has to come free. Somehow, some way. He would have known that too. Hence, probably why he took it upon himself to say, I'm going to deliver you and make this action. Does it make sense? Yes.
Well, in the scripture, it doesn't say, I mean, it's not explicitly stated that Moses knows he's going to be killing this guy. It's implicit, maybe, because he looked around to make sure nobody was watching. But then, but then he struck him so that he died. It could have been that he just wanted to get him to stop beating him, and he hit him too hard.
It's possible. It doesn't describe whether it was an accidental murder or accidental killing or not. Either way, not permissible. Even, cause you cannot strike the Egyptian. Either way, it was unacceptable. He was a type of king. It would have. I think Moses probably knew enough, just a guess, you're right, it's implied, he knew enough that this could probably injure or cause great injury to this man, potentially killing him. His life is not such that it was hard to kill somebody. They could be with blunt instruments regularly. It wasn't that hard. Because they didn't have medical equipment, no ER doctors, there's no ambulances, nobody comes to rescue. You're like, oh, look, you got struck. Oh, look, it's infected. Ooh. And they watch you die. That's pretty much all that happens. Like, it was just a paper cut. Well, now you're dead. You know? So there's a lot of disease and problems they have that they can't, they didn't decide to solve. They didn't know all the details about them. Now I realize they weren't idiots. They knew some stuff. But the point is that the stuff we have today, you takes a lot to kill somebody. You could shoot someone, they still live through it. He has taken somebody else's. Bear's property, exactly. Yes.
So you're telling me they can mummify their dead kings, but they can't figure out how to solve a cold?
I didn't say colds. Actually, a lot of them died from that, so maybe they couldn't. I don't know. Yes, Gary.
I was actually kind of thinking along the same lines as what Larry said.
Larry's like, mm-hmm.
And then this actually, on my phone, it actually shows it is the same Hebrew word from where it says the Egyptian was beating the Hebrew. Mm-hmm. That word for beating is the same Hebrew word as in my KJV. It says Moses slew the Egyptian, but it's the same word which means to strike.
Right.
It's not necessarily, that what? Word doesn't necessarily infer the intent to kill.
It doesn't mean that you had to kill him, but using the same terminology would imply that both methodologies of striking could result in killing, because if the Hebrew was just being, you know, whipped on his back and he could get up and go get to work again, Moses probably saw that every day, all the time. So why would this one instance be a problem and all the other instances he could be ignored? So, Strahler broke the back. So this point, Moses would have recognized this particular striking the Egyptian was doing was harsh enough. It was unjustified in his eyes. He decided to stop it, to affect it. It's important we understand that most because Messiah does the same thing, not by a physical striking, but he does something else which is similar in its nature. Let's move forward. Any questions? Okay. We're a little bit here. Moses, of course, has to leave. He takes off when obviously Pharaoh finds out. This is the principle that all of us should be aware of. Never forget this. It's an important thing we always remember all as long as you live. Same principle Messiah points out to us. When the armies surround Jerusalem, flee. Don't stick around. So Moses comes to us. He killed the Egyptian. Pharaoh doesn't like him. What do you do? Flee. Don't stick around. Print. Get away from the problem. Don't stick around and say, okay, I'll accept it. No. You've done something which you believe is right. Don't stick around. It's a problem for you. It ends poorly. So Moses leaves. It's a principle to not forget. Not saying you should run away from all your crimes and problems. The point is, when bad things happen and you are justified, be aware, don't wait for the misery and the axe to fall if you know it wasn't right. Yes?
Even the insects do that. Like the flea said, let us fly, and the fly said, let us flee.
Yes, you're right. Insects do that too. Everything does that. Oh, this hurts. I'm going to leave. It's pretty instinctive. This hurts. I'm going to get out of here. Let's move on. Moses takes off. Of course, he goes to his father-in-law's flocks, which, of course, symbolic nearly of Messiah's, obviously going to his father's flocks. Similarly, being the good shepherd and such. Yada, yada. I won't go into the details behind that similarity. Other than the fact he chose to water those flocks for his father-in-law, much like Messiah waters his flock for his God. Anyway, move forward. Read chapter 3, the thorn bush, the bush on fire. Thorn bush, chapter 3 of Exodus, the thorn bush, or the fire in the bush and the fire, however you want to word it. Where did my marker go? Oh, no. Where did my marker go? Oh, here it is. So, bush on fire, it's a thorn bush. I'm saying again, it's a thorn bush. Thorn bush. What's a thorn look like? What was it? Thorns, yeah. So, you have a bush with lots of things, it has spiky thorns on it, right? Okay, these are like lethal size, but the point is, they're really big thorns. All right, it's important. It's a thorn bush. It's not a briar, not a bramble. It's a thorn bush. It's important to remember. There's a difference. These aren't small thorns. These are big thorn bush. Yes? It kind of looks, okay, come on. Thanks for my artistry skills. Thorn bush. Thorn bush is on fire. So what's Moses see? We're going to draw a little bush here. And it's a thorny bush. It has fire on it. Not consumed. Okay, this is not complicated, pretty simple. A fire that doesn't consume the thorn bush. The thorn, it's a sight, it's a spectacle. Moses, I gotta go see this. This is something strange. This is weird. It won't burn up. Now, mind you, this fire, which it already tells us, is the angel of God speaking as if it's God. So Moses looking at God, essentially, not physically, but symbolically, looking at God, which is a big fire, with a thorn bush, and the thorn bush isn't being consumed. What did Messiah have on his head when he died? What do people say? Look at the spectacle. Because he was a spectacle, wasn't he? But Messiah doesn't let death consume him, does he? He comes back again, right? It's the same symbolic principle. What Moses is looking at, he's looking at the Messiah. He just doesn't realize it because it looks like fire and thorn bush. But the symbols are being used. It is not a mistake or a happenstance or a flippant choice that God chose a thorn bush to use and chose a fire to do it and chose the thorn bush could not be consumed and that it would be a spectacle for Moses to come see. These are on purpose because it's symbolic what Messiah is doing and that's told to us in the three symbols that are used when he says, Moses, go use these three symbols, these three miracles to show the people that I sent you. Yes, Dan.
Is the blood and the water...
That's
the
one of them.
Same thing?
Yes, that's one of them. So was the snake, and so was the hand. Yes. Oh. The other side.
Twice in the first part of 3, this mount is referred to as the mountain of God.
Correct.
Why?
Why? What do you mean, why? What? Because he owns the whole world, right? Yeah, what's the difference?
It has a reputation as being the mountain of God, but... Does that go back to
Abraham? Nothing before that? No, it does not go back to Abraham. This is the wrong location for Abraham.
So
this being a mountain of God, it got its title because Moses was speaking to God on the mountain. He's the one who named it the mountain of God. It's just mountain near Horeb. He titled it that way because he was talking to God. Because when God explained in the bush, explained, I'm the God of your father, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Moses was afraid because he was now talking to God. This is God's mountain. He's on this mountain. This is a bush that's burning. This is how Moses perceived it. So he wrote down, this is God's mountain. Now, God then referred to the mountain the same way. The people will believe you, not by the signs really, but when they come back here and I speak to them from this particular mountain, they will then believe that I sent you at that point. Yes, the miracles will help, but that's not the way in which God is going to believe that they're going to believe that God sent you. They'll believe you all the way along the way through miracles, but reality is when they get here, that's when they'll truly believe. Which we have. Because people challenge Moses along the way. Hey, I'm hungry. I'm thirsty. I'm starving. Why do we go back to Egypt? What's wrong with you? So they finally got the mountain of God and said, oh, wow, hey, that big fiery thing, it speaks. They said, whoa, that's big, okay. Obviously, that ain't Moses. Somebody else is talking. And that's they realize this is God who's speaking. Now, they saw the plagues, they saw the miracles. They still didn't truly believe until they saw God talking to them and said, okay, yeah, that's bigger than what we saw back in Egypt. And they started back away. Then they realized that was God. So God chose the mountain. Not there's something special about it. Oh, it's a holy place. No. It just chose a mountain. It's only holy as long as God sets it there. And holy means set aside. God set it aside. I'm using it for this purpose. When I'm done with it, is it still holy? No. It's done. Yes, done.
So you mentioned the word thorn bush. Is the does the Hebrew say you know thorn bush? Because mine, you know, that's what I figured it was.
Yeah, it says thorn.
Mine doesn't say that. Mine just says bush.
It's a thorn bush. Specifically, it's a thorn bush, a thorny bush, and it's been described. It's used as a thorn, for big thorns. Also, they say that it has been used as a text for a bramble, which is a blackberry bush, but not generally. Bramble has a different name they actually use for blackberry bushes, but it can be used in that terms, referring to thorns on the bush. The point is. It means a very spiky thing. That's what a very spiky thing is what the word means. They've been really long. They've been really long, spiky things. And I'm sure Messiah didn't appreciate them poking into his head. So they're very pokey, long things. The word means pokey, long spikes. So they use it for a term, a thorn bush. Because they're pretty wicked looking bushes. They're not very pleasant. Personally, I've only seen them in movies. I don't want to see them in person. I'm good with that. Let's move forward. Thorn bush. See the sight? It's obviously a death. It does not consume him. Because in a bush, if a fire burns a bush, we saw when it burned up, you know, half the county, you know, a few months ago, what happens to the bush? It gets consumed. It goes away. When death consumes a man, what happens to the man? He dies. Right? Now, what was happening with Messiah? He was a special because he wasn't going to stay dead. It wasn't a stay consumed. So the fire would not consume the bush. Death would not consume the Son of God. It's same similar parallels in their symbolism alone. Of course, death does not hold him. That's correct. Now, I want to bring to you attention to some of the words that is used by the bush speaking, the fire speaking to Moses. Now, we discussed this, you know, loosely. Was it the Messiah understood suffering and had to suffer and all that kind of stuff? But points out, this is verse 7 of chapter 3. I have seen the affliction of my people in Egypt. I have heard its outcry because of taskmasters, for I have known its sufferings. This is verse 7 of chapter 3 of Exodus. I have known verse its sufferings. Did God know the sufferings yet? How so? He's watching it, but when I say I know something, I can say, well, I intellectually know it, or I've experienced it. When I experience it, I know it far more than intellectually. For example, being hit by a train, I can know intellectually that would hurt. I may not live through it. But if I get hit by a train, and I do live through it, I really know what it means hit by a train. Right? I know it. I know it wholly and completely. I really truly know it. God knows wholly and completely everything, right? So in this statement, we can say, well, God never actually went into slavery. He wasn't being whipped. How could he truly know it? Because he's going to be. It's a reference for the future. Mind you, this bush that's speaking is Messiah. So this bush is explaining to you, I know their suffering because I know what it's going to be because I'm going to go through it. I'm going to get whipped. I'm going to go through the same process. They're going to slowly torture me to death the same way. I get it. I know what it's like. I know what it's going to be like. Mind you, God is not in our time frame. He can speak to Adam today and me at the same time because he's not in our time cycle. He interacts with the whole thing. The whole thing is one thing. So he can sit there and talk to Moses and say, I know they're suffering because I'm currently being whipped at Messiah's life. I'm currently being whipped while I'm talking to you, Moses, because I know all of it. I experience all of it. I understand all of it. It's all one thing. There's no time with him. So he understands and feels everything that we understand and feel. We think it sequentially. Thank you, sir. He does not. He understands all at once. It's one combining thing. Makes sense? Hopefully it makes sense. So he truly does know their suffering. He understands what it's like. He can understand and comprehend it. When he refers in verse 8, I should rescue it. Escape for his people, for the hand of Egypt, to bring it up from that land to a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, a place of Canaanite, the Hittite, Amorite, Perizzite, Hivite, and Jebusite. This statement here, which we've discussed at times past, which always remember that this is a physical explanation of a spiritual concept. When we look at our lives and God, some way you're going to save me and deliver me for something, what are we expecting to be delivering us to? We expect the everlasting life, eternal life, living forever. That's what our promise is. So this physical promise he's talking to Moses is a physical example of a spiritual promise that he's intending to use. This bush is explaining that, do this, Moses, bring the people out, and I would live them to the promised land, which our promised land, of course, is everlasting life, dwelling with God forever. That's the goal. That's our objective. It is a good and spacious land, right? It's full of milk and honey, right? It's easy and more easy. That's not the right word. It's more pleasant than we currently experience. So it's a symbolic in its nature. Of course, he explains in verse 13, they're not going to trust the miracles, but they'll explain when they come to the mountain. Behold, the covenant of Israel, and say to them, the God of your forefathers sent me. What's his name? What shall they say to them? Now, this is the only introduction, only time which God explains or tells his name. He doesn't give himself the name of, what, any other name you can think of? God. He doesn't use the word God. He doesn't use the Lord. He doesn't use the word Adonai. He doesn't use any other name. He doesn't use the word name Baal. He doesn't use any other name or title for anything else that's ever been used. What does he use? Hayah. I am. Now, can you imagine a God saying, you worship me? Who are you? I am. You are what? I am. You are what? What are you? Are you a goat? Are you a dog? Are you a... I am. That's not a name. Ah! That's not a name! It's not supposed to be! Because if it was, you would name a rock that thing. You would name this... Oh, as we learn later on with Jeroboam and else, look at the calves. This is your God. And they named the name. Because you can name a thing. You can't name an existence.
So he tried not to make any identifier.
Right. So you can't take it and put it on something else and say, this is I am. No, you're right there. That's not you. I'm here. No, you're not. I mean, because I am is not a name. It's not an identity you can label on something. Right. Exactly. The same principle. You can't name it. That's the point. You don't want to name it. Yes.
I have been learning that in the Bible, it's either you find the verbs are in either past tense or in future
tense. Or future tense, right.
So it makes really good sense when you hear God and you hear the Messiah saying in the present tense, I am.
Yeah.
It's like out of
it's not,
the
it's,
tenses.
Yeah, it's out of tenses. It's just exist.
Yeah.
That's just exist. You can't worship... What God do you worship? I worship the existed one. The one that exists. What's that? The one that exists? What's his name? He exists. You can't identify. You can't label it. You can't say it looks like this or acts like that. No. It's just, it exists. I am. It's just it's not a real thing that you can label. It's on purpose. Because God knew you can't label anything that. It wouldn't fit. You say, I am's over there. No, you're not. You're right here. No, the other I am. No, there's only one I am. Because you can't label the thing. I'm going to go worship the I am. You worship yourself? No! That's the point. It's trying to make it nearly impossible to label him on something else. Does that make sense? Yes, Sean.
Pulling a Richard Agee here. You can accept this, throw it out. It may be garbage. But one of the things that when I think about what Paul describes in First Corinthians 13 in the love chapter, and then also in Galatians 5, right? When you start looking at all those attributes, love, mercy, kind, all that stuff that's throughout, when it's I am or I will be, you look at those attributes and things that he's done, doing, and will do. I think that's
how you identify
the weightier matter of the Torah.
Yeah, that's how you identify. That's what the I am means. Because you cannot ascribe mercy until you can give an example of what mercy means. You can't describe favor until, what is favor? Well, I have to give you an example. Favor means this. What does that mean? I have to use examples to show it. Well, he is these things, but if I can't use an example to show it, it's really hard to describe, isn't it? It's really hard. Try to describe love without giving an example. Well, it's like with affection. What's that mean? What's like? I want it. Oh, you like? You want to go potty? No. Yeah, exactly. Just you'll understand it when you experience it, right? That's the nature of which you grow up. You experience it, then we'll get there. Yes, Larry.
Well, I read one of the Bibles somewhere translates that, I am the self-existing one.
Right.
Which is different from us, because we exist because he exists, but he exists...
independent.
Yeah.
Yeah, without us. We don't. He doesn't require someone else to identify, to make himself be. So this is the hand up. Who was it? Don.
It's pretty easily answered, I'm pretty sure. Jesus himself said, before Moses was, I am. Mm-hmm. So he must have been talking to him in Hebrew, first of all.
Yeah.
And that's why they got all, what?
You know, yep. Yeah. Right, he was. That's true. Yeah, because that's who he is. He's identifying himself. And, of course, the bush says that's who he is, and it implies that Messiah is the bush, or it's the same spirit. Now let's move forward. I'm almost done. Let's see. So we're going to go a little further along here. Let's see here. The three symbols. The serpent, the leprosy bosom thing, and the water and blood thing. So these, a lot of people talk about these things. A lot of different ways of interpreting them. No one is right or wrong. There's different ways people view them. They view them differently depending on who they are. But if I try to look at these, okay, well, in the context of what Moses is going to go through and what he's going through, what these symbols mean to him, and what they mean to the Israelites, and what they mean to the Egyptians at that time. Because that's if, when you try to identify a symbol, explain what did the people there at that time think the symbol meant. So that explains a little bit more. It helps a little bit. Not always, but helps a little bit. In this instance, the serpent. The only thing Moses really would remember or know about the serpent is the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden. That's best part of shit. Other than that, the serpent doesn't show up. There's no really stories about him. Any great things, just a serpent. Okay, but we know the story of the Garden of Eden. What was the serpent of the Garden of Eden doing? What did it do? What was its function in the Garden of Eden? To deceive.
Yeah,
to deceive and to manipulate, to make people do the things they would not normally do. That was its job. Now, God said with Adam and Eve and the serpent, serpent, you will bruise his heel for an Adam, and he will crush your head. That was their curse. He would eat the like dust the ground and that. The serpent would bruise the heel of the man, and man would crush the head of the serpent. What's Moses grab? The tail. Why not the head? Besides the fact that's the business end. Besides that, but who else? The serpent's supposed to represent Satan, the devil, the adversary, the one who's against, right? If you grab its tail, can it run away? No, you have ownership. You have control over it, don't you? I watched it even on TV with the guy who's dead now. He got killed by a stingray. But with the whole snake today, he grabbed the tail. Poison snakes, the snake couldn't do anything with him. Because when you grab the tail, you have ownership over it. Now, mind you, Moses is a messianic figure. So what tail is Messiah grabbing? What tail is Messiah grabbing? Right. So what is it showing us? He has control over this one. And it turns into a simple stick, a tool. It's no longer its own accord. It goes back from a snake into a stick and a staff. A word does burn, that's true. But and he casts it in the fire, which he will. But the nature of it is that we see a symbol of the Messiah. Moses is delivering Egypt, or is he out of Egypt? He's clearly a messianic figure. He's delivering them. That's what Messiah is supposed to do. So he's delivering them out. We see in the symbol of the snake, and which we understand basically what Moses' previous experience would be in knowledge about Adam and Eve, that this snake represents something that is dangerous to me, bites my heel, I crush its head, but I'm grabbing its tail instead, and it's turning back into my own power. I'm taking control over this thing that could hurt me and kill me. Is now mine, as if I own it, as if it is mine. It's his own personal stuff anyway. So it really is his. Yes, it can't do much. Let's move forward. The next symbol used, the hand, the bosom, and it comes out leprous and comes back again, and it's flesh again. Why on earth would God care and do that? It doesn't matter if the hand's white or not. Who cares? Ah, Moses doing the symbol to the Israelite leaders and presumably to Pharaoh himself, too, though he doesn't describe that part to Pharaoh's, in Pharaoh's eyesight. But God does tell him to do it to Pharaoh, too. Whose hand is Israel being delivered by? Mighty hand of God. So if God has, as he says over and over, I have an outstretched hand, up my hand, a strong arm, strong hand. What's that hand look like? Death. So if you are on Egypt's side, the death hand is raised. What does it mean to you? God's hand's against you. Death is coming upon you. Leprosy, disgustingness, evilness, corruption is coming upon you. It's the nature of what the symbol is going to mean to the people there who are watching it. Because mind you, as far as the Hebrews are concerned, up to this point, what Egyptian hand is against them? A very healthy one with a long whip, and it whips and strikes. That's the only hand the Hebrews receive, is the hand of Egypt. It's a very strong one. God's going to convert the hand of Egypt into a dead one. And he's going to they're going to receive the dead hand against the Egypt, which is what happens. So we see, again, another symbolism of what's going on here. The last one is the water and the blood thing. By itself, it seems strange, because that's gross. But think about it. When Messiah dies, which we discussed many times in the past, John the Baptist records it. They cut him open. What comes out? Water and blood. That's not a happenstance. That's not a mistake and an accident. John then records in 1 John the symbols that all agree about the Messiah. The water, the blood, and the Spirit. They all agree. Spirit being God himself. So the water and the blood is a witness of Messiah. So when Moses is taking the water and pouring it out on the ground, it is a witness of Messiah being poured on the ground. Why those two symbols? What does water symbolize in the book of Psalms? Cleansing and life. Water represents cleansing, to wash and to keep it clean, and life, to revive something inside of its soul. A well of water, exactly, to bring forth life. We also, from the Torah, what does blood mean? The life is in, yeah, the flesh and blood and life. So God is pointing out with this example of the water and the blood that I'm taking life of the Spirit, or life of revivalness, and life of your flesh, and they are both being poured out. They're both being symbolically dumped on the ground for you. Because if I dump on the ground, God said, you pour the blood on the ground because life's in the blood. He wants it poured on the ground. What does that gain you for all those sacrifices? Life. Because when you sacrifice to God, you're offering something up to him. The reason is that he wants you're asking for a granting or extension of whatever good things you need in life, either for your health, for your prosperity, you're thankful for the kindness he's given to you, whatever may the sacrifice be, or even your sins. You pour it on the ground. Well, not all the sin, part blood, but part of it does. It gets poured on the ground. You are dumping that life on the ground in your place. So you're dumping a spiritual life on the ground in your place and a physical life on the ground in your place. And so God's using the spiritual and the physical, the blood and the water, and the wine, the water, sorry, not wine, blood and water, mixed together, and the symbol gets mixed up as it gets poured on the ground. So life gets poured on the ground for us. So we see that example, and of course also with the Nile turns to blood later on. So we see these symbols being used. God's using, mixing life and life together to grant the Israelites freedom to live. That's what he's using symbols for. So these are the three symbols that God gives to Moses to explain to the people what to do. We're going to end with this part with Moses' reaction. Doing all this and all this great prophecies and these great things that God's going to send Moses out to go do, Moses has one particular issue. What is his issue? What was that? I can't speak. I don't want to go. I'm scared. Send somebody else. Moses complains. I don't want to go. I can't speak right. Send somebody else. Anybody else. Any human. Not me. I'm afraid. I'm too afraid to do this. This is too scary to me. Jeremiah chapter 1. Same problem. Same type of person. This is the second Haftorah reading portion. This is a different philosophy, the same principle. Jeremiah chapter 1. The words of Jeremiah, the son of Hilkiah, of the priests who were in Anathoth in the land of Benjamin. This is Jeremiah chapter 1, now in verse 2. To whom the word of the Lord came the days of Josiah, son of Ammon, king of Judah, in the 13th year of his reign. It came also the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, the king of Judah, until the end of the 11th year of Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, until the carrying away of Jerusalem captain the fifth month. This is Jeremiah. Now we're in chapter 1, verse 4. Then the word of the Lord came to me, saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I sanctified you, and I ordained you a prophet to the nations. Then I said, ah, Lord God, behold, I cannot speak, for I am a youth. The Lord said to me, Do not say I'm a youth. But you shall go to all whom I send you, and whatever I command you, you shall speak. Do not be afraid of their faces, for I am with you to deliver you, says the Lord. The Lord put forth his hand and touched my mouth. And the Lord said to me, Behold, I have put my words in your mouth. See, I have this day set you over the nations and over the kingdoms, to root out and to pull down, to destroy and to throw down, to build and to plant. Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Jeremiah, what do you see? I said, I see a branch of an almond tree. And the Lord said to me, You have seen well, for I am ready to perform my word. The Lord came to me the second time, saying, What do you see? I said, I see a boiling pot, and it's facing away to the north. And the Lord said to me, Of the north calamity shall break forth on the inhabitants of the land. For behold, I am calling. All the famous kingdoms of the north, says the Lord, they shall come, and each one shall set his throne at the entrance of the gates of Jerusalem. Against all its walls all around, against all the cities of Judah, I will utter my judgments against them concerning all their wickedness. Because they have forsaken me, burned incense to other gods, and worshipped the works of their own hands. Therefore, Jeremiah, prepare yourself, arise and speak to them all that I command you. Do not be dismayed before their eyes, lest I dismay you before them. Behold, I have made you this day a fortified city and an iron pillar, and bronze walls against the whole land, against the kings of Judah, against its princes, against the priests, against the people of the land. They will fight against you, but they shall not prevail against you, for I am with you, says the Lord, to deliver you. It's very powerful. It's important that Jeremiah, don't be afraid. What's telling Moses? Moses, don't be afraid. We can get you through this. You'll do fine. I give you words. I make mouths. I teach them to say, just do it. Is it scary? Yes. He's going before a Pharaoh. It's like going before Herod. What's the difference? Don't say anything wrong. You spell it wrong, you die. Bad things. Anything can go wrong. He can kill you. Is it scary? Of course. Is it for anybody? For anybody, if God puts you somewhere, yeah, it might be scary. Trust him, he'll be okay. It's hard, I get that. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it's simple or easy. It's difficult, it's supposed to be. But that's the nature of what God commanded these two men, at least, to go do. Was it a pleasant message? No. Was it beneficial to the people hearing it? No. Were they going to say, yay, let's throw a party? No. Were they a patch on the back, good job? No. Was it encouraging? Oh, I know it was hard for you. It's okay. No. What did they say? Kill it. Go away. I hate you. You should be dead. How dare you speak such things to me? Those are the words they received. Was it pleasant? No. Wasn't supposed to be. It's hard. It's supposed to be hard. So Moses was afraid. Yeah, rightfully so. What he was going to do was a difficult thing to do. Most of us would probably cower in fear. Say, you want to do what? Is the person behind me you're referring to? Because I know you can't. Yeah. If God spoke these words to us, what would we do? You say, what do you want me to do? You want me to do what? Go risk everything I have, my life, my existence? Yes, he is. Is it easy for us? No, it's not. Would he want to do it? Probably not. That's the hard part. Most of us couldn't even dream of doing it. We'd probably cower and give up. It's very difficult. Messiah did it similarly. So Messiah was not thrilled by this nature, but he had to do it anyway. Yes, Anne?
It's encouraging to think, you know, Jonah went the wrong way, went the other way too, you know. And when it comes to our turn, you know, no, Lord, I kind of delayed. I delayed coming out to California because I knew this was going to be a really difficult job with my aunt and that. And I look back now, and it took me a year to decide. Now, God doesn't usually let you have that much time. You know?
No, he doesn't.
But somehow Angie survived, you know, without me up until December. And then the state came in and took her and put her in a nursing home. So I had to do something. I had to either get the house and go to court and do all that or just let it go to the state. And so, you know, he put the pressure on. So, you know, when the time comes.
The time comes, it's hard, but you have to do it anyway.
You just move out and take it step by step.
Yeah. Don.
Yeah, first of all, but because I really don't know how I would react.
It's hard.
But I might be jumping the gun a little bit. Why did Pharaoh just kill Moses?
Why didn't he?
Why didn't you just kill him? He had the power. Maybe it's too soon for that.
Oh, sorry, I shut down. That's right. I'll explain it with words up here. I'll explain why. When Moses returns to Pharaoh and returns to the one he's talking to, this is most likely Moses the third or his son, Amenhotep the second, but probably the third because he was between the two men, just so you know this, Moses the third was the most powerful Pharaoh ever. He even was more powerful than Ramses. He was really, really powerful. Amenhotep the second, his son, spoke really, really powerfully, but he was a coward. So it's hard to say who was what, but both of them spoke boldly. But who was Moses? Oh, thank you. Put it up there. I'm going to go back a couple of... Where did my little clicker go? This page. We'll go this one. Back this way. Okay. Now, Moses was the adopted son of the girl Hatshepsut, right? The adopted son. She married Thutmose II. Moses, for 30 years, was the firstborn son now of Thutmose II. He was going to be the true pharaoh, the true king. It was that Moses II had a son through Iset, however you pronounce her name, getting Thutmose III, that Moses was now said, okay, sayonara, you're no longer firstborn king. But in a family that adopts someone, adopts a male, adopts a child, and you are the firstborn, you're the adopted son, all rights are yours, regardless of how many more children I have. It's still yours. Thutmose III does not know if he was rightfully the pharaoh. His mother ruled, which is Moses' mom, ruled with Thutmose III for 20 years, and he obeyed her instructions for 20 straight years as pharaoh. She was in charge. That was his entire life, first third of his life, that Moses' mom was in charge. So when Moses' mom dies, and Moses comes back to Egypt, because she's dead, this guy's dead, they're all dead, and he's dealing with this guy grew up with Moses, his big brother. Is he going to willingly kill him? He doesn't even know if he's rightfully should be the king. Mind you, if you're Thutmose III and you receive that God's going to kill the firstborn of son and you're not dead the next day, why not? In God's eyes, you weren't the firstborn son. What does it say to Thutmose III? Moses was the firstborn son. Now, what did Thutmose III actually do after the Exodus? Mind you, he lived through it. What did he do afterward? He then spent defacing every example of this woman's image that he could find and carved anywhere. He was mad at her. And Egyptian religion, if you erase someone's image and name, they die in the afterlife. Now, he also spent time erasing her assistant, her primary advisor as well. Scraping. They have exit of the scraped off image of her. Very detailed scraping off of her. Every detail's gone. As well as all of her advisors too. The guy, the old man. He's an old man. But he spent effort after the Exodus. Why? He was mad. Why was he mad? Because of her willingness and strength in order to maintain Moses as being his brother, his older brother, caused this misery to Egypt. Does that make sense? So he is just as much afraid of Moses as being the rightful heir as anything else. There's a rivalry. They don't know, hey, do you kill your older brother? Do you not? Now, Jacob's sons were afraid, well, after a while, to kill Joseph because he's our own blood. We shouldn't kill him. Now, he's an adopted son. Now, he's not biology, but he's adopted that way. So as far as Egyptian law is concerned, adopted the same as you gave birth to them. Makes no difference. So the law should be to Moses being the rightful heir. He finds out after the death of the firstborn, Thutmose III, he's still alive and not dead. Mind you, his son died. Amenhat, the firstborn son, he died in that plague. But the secondborn son, Amenhat the second, he lived. It was through a different queen. Satya gave birth to this one. His firstborn son was a lady named Amurtal Hashput, named after his mom. They're also all related. I know it's gross, but they were. Their family trees go vertical in these lines. They keep the family. It's like it's a palm tree, not an oak. It's very straight. They're all related anyway. But the second one is one who takes the control, not this firstborn son. Firstborn son's dead about the same time as the plague. So we understand that Pharaoh didn't just say, kill Moses. He grew up. Moses, his older brother, was the rightful heir to the throne. And he, Thutmose III, is the usurper. He's just as much afraid of Moses as Moses is afraid of him. Make sense? Okay. Any other questions or comments? Yes, Anne.
Is all of this in Josephus?
No. This is in Kitchen. Kitchen's book. Kenneth Kitchen. He wrote a book about discussing the details of the pharaohs and their lines based on 1906? Oh, crud. I forgot. Early 1900s. He wrote a book discussing these details. He also wrote a few other books, too, and it changed later. I'm sorry, I should be careful. There were two Kenneth Kitchens. The first Kenneth Kitchen. The second one's alive today. Kenneth is the first name, last name's Kitchen. Kenneth Kitchen. The first one wrote this book years ago. And the second one is alive today. Different man, both religious men, for different reasons. He writes a different topic. So this book, it has to do with those details. They're discussing he did a basic principle that all of us would do. You read Solomon, and Solomon says for 480 years. And go back. What's 480 years earlier? These pharaohs are in charge. Really, really simple. All right? Nothing scholarly, crazy, jumping hoops. He just said, what's 480 years before the temple being built? Assumed Solomon was correct. And he lands right in the middle of this mess. And he notes that Moses III, Kitchen wasn't sure if Thutmose III or Amenhotep II was the right king. They're not positive, which because it's right in the time thing of both those guys transitioning in their existence. But Thutmose III has a whole bunch of military campaigns back to back, year after year, just tons and tons, again and again and again, and all of a sudden it stops. For 15 years. Does nothing again. I said, well, what happened? Thutmose III, I just said it again, does military campaigns, again, year after year, like 20-some-odd military campaigns, year after year after year, nonstop, expanding, and all of a sudden, they all end and vanish. He doesn't do another one. For two more pharaohs, no more military activity at all. Nothing happens. He says, wait a minute. What would cause the most powerful pharaoh in the history of Egypt at this point to all of a sudden say, I quit. And his son say, I'll sign every peace deal I can get. Peace treaties, just let me sign them. Because there's no military left. Why is there nothing left? The Red Sea just took them all out. So he argued, wait a minute. It's a change of character behavior, these men, all of a sudden, all in 1 year. It just instantly happened. Guess what year it was? 1446 BC. Was the last year he did anything militarily speaking for the next 20 some odd years, almost 30 years. Nothing. Because all the military is now at the bottom of the water. You start all over again. You have to rebuild people. Okay, you can't do it that quickly. It takes time. It's to train. Do you know how to fight? Let's teach you how to fight. All that stuff. Now, if you look very carefully, your Bible says, do not say Pharaoh himself died in the water. It doesn't actually say that. So Pharaoh's chariots and all Pharaoh's men went in there. It does not say that he died in the water. None of these men died in the water of the Red Sea. None of them dead. No Pharaoh has been recorded dead, drowned in the water anywhere. Yes.
So this particular source, Kenneth Kitchen, in the early 1900s.
Yeah.
So why do you suppose that our people, the scholars, would not listen to Solomon in the first place?
Because they get confused with the one term that the Israelites built the city of Ramses. They think city of Ramses, it must be by Ramses. And they search through Ramses' stuff. But if they bother to look at this, they see something very different. There's only one hieroglyphic record of foreigners building bricks in Egypt. Only one. All the hieroglyphs says nothing. It's all Egyptians doing it, but there's one that's not. It's this guy, a guy named Tumah Rankemeyer. He was a visor and assistant in Thebes. He's in the middle of Tutmosis III's reign, right in the center of it, and he dies. These are all Hebrews making, foreigners making bricks out of mud. No other record exists. Because they've been searching at Ramses' time, the pharaoh before, during, and after. They couldn't find it. They have reference to Ramses' son, who makes a peace deal with the Israelites. And they're making trade and business. That's not the same. Because the Israelites are in the wilderness for 40 years. They can't make peace deals. They're making trade agreements. Nothing of the sort. So they have descended. They said it doesn't make sense. They assume it just didn't happen. Well, if you assume it doesn't happen, fine. But if you don't assume it didn't happen and search for it differently, and say, let's just assume the Bible is not lying to me, so it's telling me the truth, then where do you land? And you run it pretty smack dab in the middle of this stuff. It's really simple. Now, mind you, this is using the low chronology, which means there's a high and low of Egypt chronology of old of age, how old things are versus how young things are. There's about 80-year difference. So using low chronology then here, high chronology you land somewhere else. You're in the middle of Tutmosis the fourth reign of high chronology. They don't know which one's right, but you only have about an 80-year window where it's going to be right or wrong, because they're all about that time chart. Now realize Egyptology and history it changes as they learn more stuff and try new things to figure out ages and stuff. Because Egyptians, for all the good things they did, they were bad record keepers. They just weren't very good at that. Yeah, they wrote tons of stuff. Look at those carvings. It was terrible record keeping. Because let's just see guys building stuff. It doesn't have a book. It doesn't write anything down. Dates, times, none of that stuff. So they don't record most of those things. So it's really hard to figure them out sometimes. But middle 1800s, early 1900s, after enough British men went and took Egypt and started to dismantle all their archaeology to the British Museum, they said, okay, how did this work? That's when they started to feel, okay, how does this work? And they peeled it all out and made sense then. So this version is very commonly available. Lots of places have it. You will not find it in the theory about Ramses being the pharaoh. But you will find a theory about Moses being the pharaoh. And so it's very evident, very, very common there. Make sense? Okay. Any other questions or comments? I need to call it quits. I'm way over time. We'll end with a prayer. Almighty God, thank you for your wisdom and kindness of each one of us, Father. Please help us to learn, understand, and follow as best we can. For you are a great leader, a great, kind, generous God. Help us to be your people, and you will be our God, and we will trust you, and you will be pleased with us. Bless us the rest of our Shabbat, Father, as we eat and we celebrate and worship with one another and visit and talk, that your words will be shown and your explanation will be taught to us, that we be strong, vibrant people. We praise you, Father, and ask your blessing of protection and life. In Yeshua's name, amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.